The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, January 3rd, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Vali Nasser, the Majid Kadouri Professor of Middle East Studies and International Affairs at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, on our assassination of the top Iranian military leader and an Iraqi militia head. Also on the program, in a futile attempt at making this a casual Friday, Alex Perrine from the New Republic will be here. Also on the program, top story, U.S. assassinates top Iranian military leader. Congress and European allies kept totally in the dark. Ooh, maybe a prelude to war. Maybe actually just simply an act of war. Meanwhile, Australia continues to burn while scientists can now isolate climate change in our daily weather. The D.C. Circuit Court hears arguments to compel Don McGahn to comply with a congressional subpoena and forcing the DOJ to turn over redacted Mueller report, as well as the underlying grand jury information. Warren dips in fundraising, and teachers top Bernie's donors. Meanwhile, Trump and RNC have a real lot of money. And new Mueller documents released show Sean Hannity was a conduit between Trump and Manafort. UN says our treatment of Chelsea Manning constituted torture. Marianne Williamson lays off her entire campaign staff. All this and more on today's program. Folks, welcome to the show. Obviously, the plan last night until about, I don't know what it was, 10 p.m. or so, maybe 9 p.m., was we would just have our typical Friday. Oh, first of all, welcome. Alex Perrine is here with us.
Thank you.
And Jamie is back. Welcome to 2020, Jamie.
Oh, thank you. And it's great to be here in 2020.
And Michael is picking up where he left off in 2019. Not here. But Matt and Brendan, of course, are here. So anyways, last night, I was thinking tomorrow we're going to come in. We're going to have a raucous time, talk about how miserable the last decade was and what kind of insanity we could imagine is going to happen this year. But apparently we should have done that yesterday.
Yeah.
Because of the recent events. So what we've done is this morning I interviewed Vali Nasser. I also interviewed Joe Cirincione. From the Plowshares Fund. We're going to release that for members. And I think what we'll do is we'll clip it and we'll put it on YouTube as well. Maybe we'll tack it to the end of the free show. I don't know. Both perspectives were interesting. For the most part, the two interviews covered some of the same terrain, but not all of it. And there was largely similar perspectives on this. But we will get to that in a moment. Before we do, Alex, we should probably watch this to just get a sense. I mean, really, look, there are the real questions here are, well, the first question, the most pressing question is, what will Iran be forced to do at this point? Every government has their own domestic pressures. Soleimani was an incredibly popular, apparently, general in Iran. He was not involved in any domestic repression. This, you know, people will hear this in the interview. the big question is what is Iran going to have to do to show that they have some type of national pride and to make sure that they, you know, the government exhibits strength to its people who largely are repressed, but at the same time to avoid a wider war? That's the first, I think, most sort of material question. The second question is, why did Donald Trump do this? And that's something we're going to talk about after the interview. But this lays the predicate for that question, because Donald Trump has no ideas about this that have not been formed by other people around him. And more often than not, when their ideas are formed around him or sold to him, they must benefit him personally. Mm-hmm. He does not have a long-standing perspective on this stuff. How do we know? Because now, I think I had heard Soleimani's name in passing, but I certainly didn't know much about him. I think maybe I read that thing in the New Yorker by Filkins, you know, whatever it was, 2 or 3 years ago, and I didn't remember any of it. But if I was someone who was like ginning for a war with Iran, and I had a very sort of like drawn out geopolitical ideology that I wanted to impose in there, I would know who that person is. Mm. Let's go back now a couple of years to when Donald Trump was running for office, and Hugh Hewitt, former NBC host, I think he was an MSNBC host at the time, was interviewing Donald Trump. Listen to this. This is dark, folks. It's dark for multiple reasons that even expand beyond Iran. Because the Kurds come up in here, too.
Are you familiar with General Soleimani?
Yes. Go ahead. Give me a little. Go ahead. Tell me.
He runs the Quds forces.
Yes. Okay. Right.
Do you expect his behavior?
I think the Kurds, by the way, have been horribly mistreated by us.
The Quds forces, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Quds forces, the bad guys.
Right.
Do you expect his behavior to change as a result?
Kurds.
No.
Sorry. I thought you said Kurds, because I think the Kurds have been very poorly treated by us. Go ahead.
Agreed. So Soleimani runs the Quds forces. Do you expect his behavior is going to change as a result of this deal with Iran?
I think that Iran right now is in the driver's seat to do whatever they want to do. I think what's happening with Iran is, I think it's one of the, and I covered it very well, I assume you saw the news conference. I think Iran is, it's one of the great deals ever made for them. I think it's one of the most incompetent contracts I've ever seen. I'm not just talking about defense. I'm not talking about a contract with another country. I've never seen more of a one-sided deal, I think, in my life. Absolutely.
Now, this is obviously incredibly disturbing for multiple reasons. He has no idea who Suleiman is.
No.
And then also, he apparently thought that we had treated the Kurds really poorly.
Yeah.
Was determined to see if he could top that as well.
Yeah.
Based upon what he did with the Kurds in northern Syria. The interesting thing about it is that I think Hugh Hewitt's premise was correct. The Iranian nuke deal was not in any way even contemplated to impact the behavior of Soleimani, who was basically in charge of the Iranian, he was in charge of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, but all of its sort of like satellite programs that are throughout the region.
Yeah.
And the whole premise of the JPOAC, or the Iranian nuke deal, was to deal specifically with Iran's nuke program, not the other stuff.
Yeah.
Donald Trump didn't seem to know any of it.
That was fascinating because it was less an interview than candidate training.
Yes.
It was a briefing for Donald Trump. Like, Hugh Hewitt was like, first, you know, asked a question and was like, let me explain.
Right.
They're the bad guys.
Give me something.
And Trump is just sort of repeating something he's heard that he knows he's supposed to believe. And Hugh Hewitt's like, I got to fill in the rest for you. those are the bad guys. We don't like them. Obama is enabling them. Like, so that it, I don't know. It's, and then, but yeah, so to believe that that guy giving that response had really any coherent reason for wanting to do what just happened then, like, it's there's no way.
Right. The only thing that we know is that he has the ability to be convinced of things when he thinks that it's in his benefit. And, you know, this question came up when I spoke to Nasser, but it's quite conceivable that any number of things happened in terms of, like, the intelligence was wrong. They thought that just the other guy, Muhandis,
right,
was present. This is the Iraqi leader of a Iranian-backed
militia group
yeah, in Iraq. And he was personally involved in the protests and the storming of the embassy. The American forces may have been trying to, you know, sort of like make a proportionate assassination, if you will.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not condoning it. I'm just trying to explain this. And didn't realize that Soleimani was there.
Yeah.
But they subsequently took credit for it.
Yes, exactly.
Which you can also see Trump going like, I'm not saying we made a mistake.
Yeah.
But it also conceivable that they got intelligence that didn't tell them that Soleimani was going to be there, because the intelligence, I mean, who's giving them the intelligence on the ground in Baghdad? It could be Iraqis who want to get Soleimani out. Could be rivals, could be Saudis, could be Israelis. I mean, these are all people who have, these are all countries that have, you know, intelligence.
Both, yeah, intelligence operations and an interest in dictating U.S. foreign policy.
Exactly. And it's also conceivable that, you know, somewhere along the line, it's, you know, MBS is like, we took care of that whole Khashoggi thing. I got rid of some of my top lieutenants, you know, my top guys. So you owe me one, right? I mean, isn't that the way it worked in like Goodfellas or whatever it was? Like, I took out one of the guys. And so now, you know, I want that share of the contract on the dock. Let's play this interview. We'll come back. We will talk more about it. This is... I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Vali Nasser, the Majid Kadouri Professor of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. We're back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor Vali Nasser. He is the Majid Kadouri Professor of Middle East Studies and International Affairs at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So let's just start. I mean, I think most people by now have at least some passing familiarity with the name Qasem Soleimani. But tell us who he was, and also who Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis was, who was also killed in this drone attack.
So Qasem Soleimani became a known name in the West after U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, when he emerged in Iraq as the mastermind of Iran's policy there, the man who initially organized the militias that ultimately would attack U.S. forces in Iraq, and also became a power broker, basically bringing together the different Shia factions in order to put together different governments and bring to power different prime ministers in Iraq. And then it became quite obvious to us that his purview of his activities was all the way from Lebanon to Afghanistan. In a sense, he was the commander of Iran's regional forces and regional presence. And he proved quite adept at that. He not only managed Iraq, but also he eventually became the singular important force in sustaining the Assad regime in power. He reputedly, personally persuaded President Putin to bring Russia into Syria. And then he also became a very known figure in Iraq, both in northern Iraq and southern Iraq, during the fight against ISIS. But in the West, he came to be known particularly for attacks on American troops. He came to be sort of the face of the Islamic Republic's most sort of aggressive regional policies against the U.S. and also other regional actors. And he became associated with terrorism in the region, with what happened in Syria. And he had become an iconic figure in American imagination.
And from the perspective of Iran and Iranians, how did they perceive him? I mean, what would be the analog, I guess, for an American audience?
Well, you know, regardless of what Iranians think about the Revolutionary Guards, the security forces, the Islamic Republic itself, Soleimani personally was very popular in Iran. At least in polling that had been done, he came up with over 90% approval rating at times as the single most popular figure in Iran, to the point that actually rumors began spreading of a political career for him as a future president in Iran. Iranians saw him essentially as sort of a maverick figure that was defending Iran's national security, particularly because he was not responsible for domestic oppression. He was rather engaged in defending Iranian interests in Syria or Iraq and or Lebanon, and so he did have a cult following, I would say, within the Revolutionary Guards, within the hardline sector in Iran, but had much broader appeal across the gamut of public opinion in Iran.
Okay, and the second man, was a close advisor of Soleimani. That is Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Can you tell us about him?
Well, we don't know much about his sort of biography. What is important? I mean, Soleimani had been grooming militia commanders, sort of analogs to Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah in Lebanon. In other words, once Iran set up proxy militias, there was always a local commander, local enforcer who was managing that group, and Mohandas was in that capacity. So he was a senior militia commander in Iraq, worked with Soleimani very closely, was very instrumental on the ground in Iraq in terms of implementing Iran's projects there. And he's not the most well-known or senior militia commander in Iraq, but he was an important figure, at least in one of the key militias that was responsible for hitting the U.S. base, and then the U.S. retaliated against it, and then this militia was instrumental in charging the U.S. embassy a few days ago. So he's an Iraqi figure. If he had been killed on his own, it would have been big news in Iraq, but it would not have had the broader global attention that the killing of Soleimani brought about. He's a much, much lesser figure, localized to Iraqi politics and Iraqi security.
I may be getting ahead here because I want to talk about the implications for what it means for protests in Iraq that have been taking place and protests that have been taking place in Iran and reformers, particularly in Iran. But since we're in this place, what are the chances, from your perspective, that our intention was not to kill Soleimani, but was rather to kill Muhandis as a sort of a more proportionate response to attacks that have been taking place in Iraq? And Donald Trump or the U.S. or somewhere along the line, someone got played about the information and the intelligence that we received?
Possible. We really don't know. But that's not what U.S. has claimed. The Pentagon, I believe, has said that Soleimani was killed under direct orders of President Trump. There has not been any kind of disavowing that the fact that he was a target. So ultimately, it's the public display of what happens that will politically matter. So within Iran or within Iraq, within the American political system, the reaction to this will be decided by what people are told publicly, by what the governments claim publicly. We might have had a different reaction had the U.S. administration come out and said that they were targeting Mohandas and that Soleimani was a lucky collateral damage. That at least would have left sort of some diplomatic wiggle room to say that the U.S. did not directly target the most senior sort of Iranian commander, the famous figure, potentially the second most well-known Iranian sort of statesman as known in the region directly, right. And that this was not a decapitation mission against Iran. That might have had a very different implication. But the U.S., the president basically claimed that he directly ordered the killing of an Iranian senior official. So Iranians will read it at face value. They cannot do otherwise. Right. And so will Americans, so will Iraqis, so will everybody else in the region.
Okay, and so explain this dynamic. I mean, this is, you know, perhaps sort of... a generic question about international relations, but at this point, the fact that it's made public and that it's embraced by the United States, this killing, this assassination, just talk about the physics. Like, how compelled now is Iran to respond, and to what extent can we get a notion of what they think will be enough of a response to satiate the, the need to respond with their domestic for their domestic constituencies.
Well, that's exactly, I think, what they're considering right now. Today, there was supposed to be a Supreme National Security meeting in Iran to decide on the response. A lot of this is really a power play. Both sides have domestic constituencies. The president of the United States wants to show bravado before the American public in an election year before impeachment, wants to show the region that the U.S. is going to stand tough. The Iranians similarly cannot get a bloody nose without reacting. I don't think either side wants war, but they've got a lot closer to it, and they're going to be goaded into this by the action and reaction cycle here. I mean, regardless of what the administration claims, the killing of Soleimani is not going to thwart whatever plans were in train for attacking U.S. Bases and U.S. personnel. I mean, Soleimani was not the personal assassin that was going to show up at the base and shoot a rocket.
Right.
You know, whatever he had put in play will continue. And the U.S. didn't actually hit a base or a group of implementers. They hit the mastermind. So this was much more of a symbolic kill, if you would, than an actually operational one. And both now the President Trump has locked himself into this sort of aggressive response. And in a similar way, the Iranians will be locked as well. Now, whether they retaliate next week or whether they retaliate in a month, I mean, that remains to be seen. But I think the Iranians also are seeing tremendous benefit in this. It's going to galvanize Iraq against the United States. It's going to divert attention from the anti-Iranian protests that were raging there. Internally, within Iran, it's going to create a rally to the flag effect. It's going to create sympathy for the ruling regime, and it's very convenient for them to divert attention from the what happened in Iran in the past 2-3 months, protests, mass killings. So in a way, actually, there are also opportunities for Iran, and Iran's going to milk that, both regionally and domestically.
So, in other words, to the extent that there was any type of momentum or protest or reformers were gaining any type of power in Iran, for people who were in Iran who were encouraging, you know, I guess a measured response to what the United States, and I want to talk just briefly about this, has done in terms of the nuclear accord, they have been disempowered.
That's all gone.
They
have been disempowered. Already they were being disempowered because of President Trump came out of the nuclear deal. But look, any political system is not very different than our own. I mean, the United States, there's always a rumor that you know, going to war is a case of a tail wagging the dog, that president's election years may look for October surprise or may look for some kind of a national security crisis that brings everybody behind the president and diverts attention from domestic politics. So Iran's no different from that. I mean, if the Iranian government sees an opportunity to sideline the moderates, but also to sort of divert attention domestically from domestic issues about economics, hardship, repression, unhappiness with the regime, and focus everybody on this confrontation with the U.S. So in that sense, it's going to be consequential. Similarly, in Iraq, I mean, it's the militia types that are now going to have the momentum in not only choosing the next prime minister of Iraq, as that's going to be taking place, but also perhaps enforcing the parliament in Iraq to demand that the United States leave the country.
So, I mean, even from the perspective of what supposedly we are led to believe the national security establishment of this country would want in terms of outcomes in Iraq and in Iran, is there any, what would be the rationale of doing this beyond, I guess, an ability to say that we could do it and a hope that it doesn't end up spiraling out of control?
I don't see it. I mean, I really don't see a clear strategy behind the entire way in which the past 2 years President Trump has handled Iran. I mean, he took a situation that was fairly stable. I mean, Iran and the United States at least had for the first time signed the deal. It might not be a perfect deal, but they signed it. Iran implemented it. Iranians were not shooting rockets at American bases in Iraq. We were in a much better position than we are today. So he taken what was a relatively stable situation, and he has created a crisis out of it, and he's not showing a way how he's going to get out of it. There's no exit ramp here, and that's extremely dangerous. So I think, if anything, once we sort of settle down from the American ability to carry out something like this and the president's sort of machismo, the begging question is, where do we go from here, and why did you bring us to this point?
Okay, lastly, do you have a sense of what type of responses are on the table? I mean, potentially from an Iranian perspective, like because I presume that what they need to do is calibrate a response that they hope will not escalate, but will satiate a domestic demand for, in terms of showing that they're strong.
So, we always can look back at what they had done historically, like bomb an embassy, attack an embassy, blow up something. But they may also surprise us, just like they did when they went after the oil facilities in the Gulf. They also may mobilize mass protests across the region and force the United States to confront people on the streets, as we saw in Iraq. I think that's exactly why they're taking their time discussing this, because there's not necessarily an easy, obvious next step for them. They know they have to do something, but you're right. They have to also calibrate and sit down and think what their next step ought to be. Well, I've got to run on.
Okay, yes. Well, Avali Nasser, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Not at all. Good speaking with you.
Good speaking with you.
Bye-bye.
So there it is, and we can speculate as to what the rationale is that Donald Trump has. Here's the most low hanging, I guess, answer to what Donald Trump thinks this is going to benefit him. How, I'm not quite sure, but when the professor was talking about when Avali Nasser was talking about creating chaos.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced that's not just an ends sometimes for Trump himself. I mean, if this was about exclusively about just enriching himself, there's chances are this could have happened at any other time.
Mm.
But maybe he also perceives it as being helpful in the context of creating disarray in the run up to Iowa who knows. But at the very least, to the extent that we have any sense of the way that Donald Trump's brain works, to the extent that it works, Let's go back to this clip from November, I think 16th, 2011, where Donald Trump was sitting in his crappy little billionaire office. I mean, Jesus.
It's like cluttered and like, yeah.
I mean, honestly, what a crap box if I for that kind of office, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we wouldn't know anything about that.
Well, I'm just saying, like, our office looks equally as crappy, but well, there's no billionaires around here. There's
but you
no,
tried to make the space, well, but you tried to make the space behind you like look nice.
Exactly, exactly. Not fake, not pictures of like pretending that I enjoy my family. Here's Donald Trump in November of 2011.
Our president will start a war with Iran because he has absolutely no ability to negotiate. He's weak and he's ineffective. So the only way he figures that he's going to get reelected, and as sure as you're sitting there, is to start a war with Iran. Now, I'm more militant and more militaristic than the president. I believe in strength. But to start a war in order to get elected, and I believe that's going to happen, would be an outrage.
Would be an outrage. I think it was finishing. Well, so, I mean, A, he was wrong. Mm. B, for those morons out there who thought, like, he is a dove, you know, maybe you should just listen to what he was saying. And C, what it does tell us, though, is that's the way that he thinks.
Well, that's the way he thinks it works. And I think we already have an explanation for a lot of his behavior, which is that he does something that gets a lot of attention and makes everyone talk about him, and then... he believes that boosts his profile, and then he wins a presidential election. And I think, like, at the very, very beginning of his presidency, I wrote a thing that was basically like, he learned early on that if he drops some bombs or does some, like, some, even if it's a sort of military catastrophe, if there's something going on with the military, that pundits will go on TV and say, he's getting presidential. He's finally getting presidential because he did some war stuff.
Right.
I think that it's possible, you know, the mainstream media conversation about this has been very alarmingly stupid, but I don't think he's getting that exactly what he imagined he would get out of it, because people are kind of wondering, well, is there a strategy here? But I think, you know, in his sort of simple-minded way, he's like, it'll be the equivalent of, it's like killing bin Laden. It'll be a great, like, people will talk about how state, like, how presidential I am. It'll shut up all my rivals. And then, like, boom, like, I'm suddenly doing looking good.
Right. And I think, and you know, I want to actually segue into sort of the response that we're getting from yeah, those type of peeps. But even absent that type of response, even a completely neutral response, centers him.
Yeah.
As the leader of the commander in chief.
Exactly.
And for him to believe that that will be, you know, that effective positioning, at the very least with his base. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the ability for him to kill somebody.
He campaigned on that. He, you know, he this goes back to his sort of self-contradictory rhetoric about war and war making, but his campaign promise was, I will kill more individual people in the Middle East, but I will not have our soldiers there. That was basically his promise.
Right.
We will be killing more people, but like, we won't have to sacrifice anything.
And his whole, the story about that, you know, general is supposedly dipped the bullets in pig's blood to shoot, Muslims, which, you know, apparently was not true, but nevertheless, that it was an effective a selling point for him. So at the very least, it's very possible that he just thinks that this is a good, this is probably maybe a threefer for him, right? Like, good for my campaign, good to change the topic of impeachment, because that will put more pressure on senators, you know. One of the things that happened over the break was that you had Murkowski and Collins coming out and saying that I think maybe we should have a legitimate trial.
Maybe we should.
And Doug Jones came out and said that we should have a trial. Mm-hmm. Manchin said that we should have a legit trial. That surprised me a little bit.
Yeah.
And I imagine it surprised the White House a little bit, and it makes them a little bit nervous. On top of which, it's also quite possible, it seems to me, that, you know, that the idea that maybe MBS feels like they've put the Khashoggi killing behind them because they just was put on trial.
Yeah, they just, like, yeah,
top you know, bodyguards who perpetrated it, the killing. Maybe they felt like now we're freed up. This is good timing. You know, sort of like what Wolfowitz said, right? This is the thing that we could all agree on.
Yeah.
And maybe the timing and the individual was just something that worked for everybody,
right.
Everybody's agendas. But let's talk briefly about the response that we've seen. And we could talk a little bit about 2020 and the implications of it. We can also talk about your piece, which I can't recommend highly enough because, it captures, you talk about a decade of liberal delusion and failure. After reading it, I was thinking like, you know what, actually the 10 years before that were also like that too. But we're seeing a lot of, and I imagine you may have had the same reaction I did. Like, I just remember people saying like, the world's going to be a better place without Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you can't deny that the world's
better. Can't deny, yeah.
He has blood on his hands. He killed his own people, blah, 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 blah. I mean, all true.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of net misery, hard to argue that killing him was such a helpful thing for hundreds of thousands of Iraqis.
Yeah.
But we saw that just immediately within moments last night.
Mm-hmm. And we saw it. I mean, it was on TV and it was Democratic officials. It was
Democratic candidates.
Democratic candidates. They lead with the justification basically for it. Lead with like, he was a real bad dude. And even, you know, like gesturing towards saying that things will be better without him. But I have some concerns about the way it was carried out because they didn't tell Senator Schumer first.
Right. Right. I mean, here's Elizabeth Warren. And I think this is there's two possible, I think, things that could come out of this, frankly, in terms of the response from the Democratic candidates. One could be that there's such chaos that people gravitate towards Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were people who were trying to make this argument about that's what happened when Saddam Hussein was killed. That hurt Dean in the run-up to Iowa.
Yeah.
Because of the sort of like there was some sense that, I don't know, his anti-war stance was not as poignant, I guess, maybe. This could create a sense of like, we need a steady hand.
Mm.
Or it could create a response of like, we need somebody who is not going to do this stuff at all.
Yeah.
And get us involved. Who's going to get us out of that region?
Yeah.
And put up Warren. I mean, I think this is going to hurt Warren, frankly. I mean, I think, you know.
Well, it's.
Put up Warren's thing here. Soleimani was a murderer responsible for the deaths of thousands, including hundreds of Americans. But this reckless move escalates the situation with Iran and increases the likelihood of more deaths and new Middle East conflict. Our priority must be to avoid another costly war. Now, she said this at 10:20. And just for the sake of trying to be, you know, sort of fair here, at least come off as fair. I don't know what time it was that I wrote this last night on Twitter. It was at 10:10. So it was 10 minutes before this. I saw this in 2002. Your quote, Soleimani was a bad guy / had blood on his hands, comma, but, end quote, take suck and will midwife a war.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like some people didn't listen to you.
Well, I mean, you know, this was so predictable. Julian Castro had the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Soleimani was a murderer responsible for the deaths of thousands of people, including Americans. However, Trump's reckless actions, blah, blah, blah.
It's practically the same. Why is that practically the exact same statement?
He didn't use but. He used however. So that makes it different.
That's a little weird.
But the thing is, you could hear virtually every single person on any news channel who was brought on to talk about this at best would say something like
yes. this. Yeah. Yeah. And that's it was remarkable listening to your interview just now because you cannot turn on television and just hear someone explaining the actual situation as clearly as it was just explained.
Yep.
I think it's a symptom of the fact that American media people and the foreign policy establishment treat America as the protagonist of world affairs. like, and therefore cannot imagine other countries will react to things that we do. Like, it's really, it's this both a combination of the, like, the black and white morality of with us or against us, but also just an inability to imagine that other countries have citizens that have interior lives and even patriotism.
Right.
So you can't, you know, to just to hear and to not be able to just say this is a military figure in another country who the people in that country believe he was defending them from outside aggressors, the outside aggressors being us, because we have been the outside aggressors against Iran for years.
We just
now
walked away from the nuke deal and yes, have immiserated millions of people in their country.
Yeah. And so we are like, oh, he's waging proxy wars all over the Middle East. We are waging proxy wars all over the Middle East. We are like in a conflict with them.
Right. Due to Tango.
Like, we are in a conflict with this, a military conflict with this country. And this was a military figure. So the murdering hundreds of Americans, he's, that we're talking about acts of war committed by a military figure against our soldiers.
Yeah, that's the thing that really jumps out to me as well when they call him a murderer of Americans. Those Americans were literally enemy combatants.
Right.
In a war.
And we should also say, the biggest project he's been working on for the past 6 to 8 months has been fighting ISIS.
Yes, exactly. Like, no one, yes, no one can even, I mean, I can't even get anyone to coherently explain what our, like, who are our allies and why in there? Like, who, like, what is the sort of just base level, like, why? Okay. He was, like, the one fighting ISIS, but we, you know, like, why are we, times, why are we allies? Yeah, sometimes
there are times where we have a common enemy.
Yeah.
And that's basically what it came down to, right? These were the Sunni Shia. The Sunni Muslims.
Yeah.
And he is Shia. And they were rivals, and they were also our rivals. And but the other, I mean, the way you're describing it in terms of that, like, chauvinism,
yeah,
is, I think, almost sort of like the best thing you could say about that response.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Because the
yeah.
other one is just sheer cowardice and cynicism.
Mm.
Right. Like, and you and I think, you know, we saw this so up close in the wake of 9/11, mm. where at the very least, like, you know, people were freaked at that
yeah.
time. And the idea that nobody wanted to be the one to sort of like open the door for a second 9/11 in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody wanted to be on the wrong side of that, even like, you know, in casual conversations,
mm-hmm.
Never mind in the context of politics. That cowardice, I think we have shown, has been that you know, we all felt on some level, right? Like, I mean, I was thinking, like, I mean, I got an offer to shoot a TV show up in Canada, and, you know, 6 months earlier, I was like, no way. This, we're shooting on the streets of New York. We could never. I'll go to Canada. And we went and shot it in Canada. I mean, it was, you know, that was the attitude that people had. People were afraid. But, and you write about this in your piece, we now know the Afghanistan war has been just a total debacle.
Mm-hmm.
It's been quite obvious the Iraq war has been a total debacle for probably at least well over a decade and a half at mm-hmm. this point. And the to show that level of cowardice,
mm-hmm.
that you need to in some way prove that you are part of the blob
mm-hmm.
and you accept the premise of the blob. Like,
yeah.
okay, but here's the thing. It's irrelevant. Even if this guy could... And I mentioned this to you earlier. Matt Stoller had this tweet. Archduke Ferdinand had it coming.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that it doesn't matter how bad of a guy this guy was. There is no evidence that he was an imminent threat to our national security.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, like, he wasn't sitting there with a trigger and he was going to blow up New York. There is going to be a reaction, and to, you know, to introduce this notion of like whether he deserved it or not
yeah.
is stupid,
yes,
and cowardly.
I think 9/11 is like worth thinking about for multiple reasons. One of which is that for people who say cynically or earnestly that. Well, you know, Iran will be Iranians. Normal Iranians hate the government and therefore will welcome American aggression against the Iranian government. Like, after 9/11, people who hated the government like became very patriotic. Mm-hmm. People who hated the American state and the politicians who make up the American state like wanted to defend the country against a foreign aggressor. But the other thing is, like, I think 9/11 crystallized why our foreign policy is so psychotic. And it's that we, outside of nuclear war, face no existential threats. Like, our sovereignty cannot be threatened. We can't be occupied and invaded. We're just too large and too strong. But we feel, I think because of the sort of way the conservative movement is governed by fear, we just feel insanely vulnerable and panicky, right? So it's like this weird psychological thing where we know we basically, like, no one is a threat to us. Like, this guy was not an existential threat to the United States, but we sort of have to, like, aggressively murder anyone who, like, as I said earlier, is killing American soldiers in the theater of war.
Right. And regardless of what the costs are associated with this.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, because the bottom line is, I mean, it really comes down to what Iran decides to do.
Yeah.
Because they could do something where they, I mean, I don't know if they have the capacity to do this, but they apparently have some very, you know, from what I've read, they have some very highly skilled, I guess, cyber warfare capabilities. But let's just say they have the ability to shut down, like, I don't know, a quarter of our grid in our country. I don't know if they do or not, but just hypothetically, they could do that and they could say nothing about it. Mm-hmm. And the United States government would know that they did it. And the United States government could either say,
I mean, we did it to them.
Right. No, we did it.
Like,
right.
We did it.
Yeah. Well, it stucks it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, but the idea is, like, there's two different ways in which they do this stuff. Right. One is you do it publicly.
Right.
Because you want to show to your populace that you've attacked them. The other is you do it, quietly, so that you basically are saying to the other government, like, look what we can do.
Yes.
And the next time, this is a warning shot, essentially. Yeah. And then how it's received. Like, for instance, if it was a mistake, the U.S. government could have said, like, we accidentally hit Soleimani, or we're happy to find out that we didn't know he was there, but we're happy to find out.
Yeah.
And then you have some wiggle room and you allow the other government to say, like, well, they didn't mean to do this. Mm-hmm. And the response is less. If they shut down quarter of the grid, the grid, hypothetically, again, Trump could say, like, we just had a problem with infrastructure and it's because of a Democratic governor, wherever it is, in whatever state, or the Iranians have attacked us and now we're going to do something else. Like, I'm not clear on what Trump's intentions are.
Yeah.
And we don't know how much Iran, and they probably don't even know yet, how much they need to respond to satiate that their domestic constituency. It's a little bit terrifying. I also think that part of it is not just I think part of it is you talk about that conservative fear. Yeah. Play this clip of Hexeth. I think there is we're in middle-aged man buys a Corvette territory with this stuff. Listen to the rationale of this lunatic. This is just sheer insanity. Like, this is junior high shit.
And emails and texts from friends in the service all across the world that said, that's the last thing we should be saying. Oh no, Iran's gonna do something. No, Iran should be worried today that maybe we'll do something again. Maybe your second general is next. If you continue to try to kill Americans, we are the top dog. You respond to us, not the other way around.
Bring the fire, Hex says. No matter
what. Well, I'm fired up.
But you're right. You're
because
right.
The president brought the fire.
Yes.
As a leader, you want your, as a follower, you want your leader to reluctantly be strong. And that's exactly what the president did here. Kudos to him.
Hold on, Pete. Stay there, please.
I mean, this is creepy stuff.
It is. I mean, it's because it's authoritarian. It's Starship Troopers. Like,
was so reluctant about it too.
Yeah, reluctant force.
And it's Hexus isn't the only one. His buddy over at Fox and Friends, what's his face, Kilmeade, also very, very jazzed this morning. Everybody's feeling themselves. Mm-hmm. This is like a shot of testosterone right in the ass for these guys.
I think that when the de-escalation at the embassy happened a couple of days ago, that was the end of this chapter. The United States, with its firmness, had won the victory. It wasn't going to be Benghazi. It wasn't going to be, Tehran from 1980. We won that tactical victory. Now we have taken this huge military escalation. Now I fear the worst. You're going to see the U.S. markets go crazy today. You're going to see the price of oil spiking today. This is a very, very big deal.
And I don't know if you heard, but this isn't about his resume of blood and death. It is about what was next. We stopped the next attack.
It was preemptive.
That's what I think you're missing.
According to the Secretary of State.
And so we should allow the next attack.
By what credible source can you predict what the next Iranian move would be?
The Secretary of State and American intelligence provided that material.
Yeah, they've been excellent. They've been excellent. The U.S. Intelligence has been excellent since 2003 when we invaded Iraq, disrupted the entire region for no real reason. Don't for a minute start cheering this on. What you have done, what we have done, what we have unleashed.
I will cheer it on.
We have. All right. Well, you, then you, like Lindsey Graham, have never met a war you didn't like.
That is not true. And don't even say that.
If President Trump wanted de-escalation,
we should just let him kill us for another 15 years.
If President Trump wanted de-escalation and to bring our troops home, what this was a reaction.
What about the 700 Americans that are dead? Should they not be happy?
You know,
because of him.
What about the tens of thousands of Iraqis who have died since 2003. You have to start seeing things. What the hell are we doing in Baghdad in the first place?
So you
why are we there? Why aren't these forces
on? You're blaming President Bush for the maniacal.
I am blaming President Bush. I am blaming President Bush in 2003 for those fake weapons of mass destruction that never existed and the con job that drove us into that war.
Geraldo, I think there's a disagreement here at the desk on all of that.
I'll tell you something. Geraldo 2020, as far as I'm concerned.
Like, Geraldo, sort of rediscovered his what he actually used to talk like, but...
I love it that his counterpoint to Geraldo was just, don't say that.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that's because, reality, like...
You think the 700 people are going to be happy now?
Yeah, don't...
700 dead?
You don't want the 700 dead Americans to be happy?
If we had three other researchers, right now, they would be tasked with trying to find... The one time, if ever, that Brian Kilmeade has said the word Soleimani in his radio program or his TV show over the past 10 years, I would put that number somewhere around zero.
Yeah.
And the idea that, like, this guy was ready to attack again, like, this has been an ongoing thing.
I think what we're seeing on Fox is, like, not just pure jingoism, but an attempt to rile people up to care about this, because Americans are just exhausted with hearing about what's going on in the Middle East. They're not invested in it. Normal people don't know who this person is. That this is literally an attempt to, like, just get some of that 2003 magic back.
Well, that's the thing that I don't fully understand here, and is that I don't think this is going to be effective as is for Trump's presidential.
No,
I think it's going to hurt.
I don't think so either, but I think that they only have a few playbooks. Like, they're not canny. They're not smart enough to know, like, this worked for them before. This is a thing that worked.
They don't realize that the missing formula was the biggest attack in 75 years on the, like the most dramatic. In fact, you know, it's the most dramatic attack. 9/11 was the most dramatic attack ever taken against the United States. I mean, people didn't see Pearl Harbor in real time.
They didn't see it live.
Yeah. And I mean, that seems to me to be a pretty big failure of analysis.
I think that we have a lot of evidence that the conservative movement is running on fumes, and in lieu of a 9/11, they're just going to try the post 9/11 playbook anyway.
The only thing I can think is that they're hoping that there is some type of significant enough of attack
to generate some of that energy again.
But I don't understand how they also think that they won't get more blame for it. I mean, look, if George Bush, if we knew, for instance, that Dick Cheney went to Afghanistan in the summer of, you know, in the spring of 2001, and said to the Taliban, we're going to do this pipeline here. And if you don't, you know, his emissary said, basically, we're either going to, you know, shower you with carpets or shower you with bombs.
or something to that effect. If we knew that, if that was like publicly known at the time, and then all of a sudden there's this strike 6 months later, people might say, like, whoa, wait a second. There was a there was a precipitating event.
Yeah.
And I don't think, like, frankly, this is the thing, is that I don't think the American public was terribly aware of what was going on at the Baghdad embassy.
I mean,
you know, we came back in. I it was during Christmas break. We mentioned it, but it had been resolved as essentially as Geraldo said. And it's going to feel like if we get attacked that it's Donald Trump's fault.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm not saying that that his people will think this, but I think I think
the feeling will be, and
the
also
center will be.
And if you like, right. And so this is what gets back to what is galling about sort of Democrats still operating on those same post 9/11 premises, much like these people are.
Yeah.
They're still operating on the same premises where they still think people will rally around military action by the commander in chief when I think people are sick of that.
Yeah.
I think Sanders has it right morally and politically.
And Donald Trump ran on that.
Exactly. We already have an example of a president successfully running on that.
Yes.
Can I say one thing that gives me hope about this?
Sure.
So Bernie has the greatest number of donations from both active duty and veterans in the military. And, you know, that largely probably has a lot to do with his time on the Veterans Affairs Committee and taking care of them after they come home. But, you know, I'm sure they're aware of his foreign policy credentials, his foreign policy beliefs, and his record, in fact, including voting against the Iraq War. And this gives me some hope, at least, that there will be a level of resistance on the part of the military and support for the only candidate with a well-articulated anti-imperial vision.
But did he have that? Does he have the most support from veterans and military personnel in the Democratic primary? Because I suspect that Trump has gotten more donations from the military.
Oh,
I may
I'm
be
not
wrong.
Sure. I gotta look that up.
I think Bernie actually did have Trump beat too, but I can,
is that right?
I can check it. Yeah.
I mean, that would be really significant.
I mean, Trump didn't do a lot of small donor fundraising.
Well, that's true too.
And I think people are starting to make.
Where are you
going to
store that swag when you're active duty? You don't have the place to, because that's the only way that you get that is you got to buy the swag.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully, like my hope is that people are making the connection between spending on war and the austerity going on in the realm of social spending, and the need to ramp down our military budget and increase our budget for things like food stamps and health care.
I don't even think people go that far. I think it's really people are sick of it. They're sick of it. And they the reality is that, I mean, Bernie had a tweet, you know, where you had these statements that were sort of like, he's bad, but we shouldn't have done it this way. Bernie's statement came out with, I think it was literally like I saw someone characterize it and I thought they were characterizing it, but it was actually that specific. It was, I was right about Vietnam. I was right about Iraq. And there was another one that he had that was much more like sort of, it was literally, I was right about Vietnam.
Yeah.
I was right about Iraq. And, we shouldn't go, we shouldn't fight this war either. Period. End of story. And it's reductive and I think accurate, but I think people want that.
I do. I agree. I also think too, like the persistence of the blob really in large part happens because they are people for whom it doesn't matter that actions have consequences, you know, like in reality itself. I think we have been talking a lot about history not going, like not moving forward or being, we're stuck in this sort of eternal present. And it goes back to reality-based community too, where everything Geraldo said was correct, and it just didn't matter.
Right.
It's The Onion had the single best piece of writing about the Iraq War ever, which was this war will be catastrophic and destabilize the region versus no, it won't. They published that in 2002 or 2003, and like it has remained true. Sanders was right. Doesn't matter.
It is. Stunning to me. When we bombed Syria, I think you and I have even talked about this. I happened to have been at MSNBC. I was going on to do Hayes's show. It was It was the 8 p.m. hour. We got word that an attack was imminent and was going to happen at basically 9, more or less. And I was there to talk about, I don't know, how dumb Donald Trump is or something like that, some, you know, segment like that. They brought me on. I was the only person in the prime time of MSNBC who said we should not do this unequivocally. Everybody else was like, we should do this, but then we need a plan.
Then we need a plan.
Who the F is going to do the plan? Like, what are you talking about? And I got brought back immediately to 2003. And frankly, the reason why I do this was that one night was worth, you know, six years of doing Nancy Pelosi's haircut or wherever the fuck, you know, they bring me on to talk about.
Yeah. And the liberal look, like, we just got to do it the right way. Like that, Biden has been the candidate of that, but it still remains the dominant, like, response among Democrats.
Is that a muscle memory that is left over, it seems to me, from the Cold War?
I mean,
we must project strength. Like, you know, Kennedy was, you know, having to, at least rhetorically anyways, project this sort of Scoop Jackson Democrat type of thing or something like that.
I think people like Biden and certainly Schumer, like, that's when they learned it, definitely. Right. But I think, like, with a lot of the rest of them, it is, like, part, you know, there's always the sort of Reagan response of, like, he made America feel sort of strong and powerful again. I feel like they're the Clinton idea that you can just have a bunch of little wars that you can just sort of finish up and be popular and then be done with them.
Well, I wonder if it's not sort of like the same thing that we're seeing in a bunch of other areas, where the generation in their 20s and 30s or just did not grow up in the shadow of that stuff.
Yeah.
And they don't have any of that Cold War stuff, right? Like, you know, it was over and they don't. I think like that is the key difference, it seems to me, between now and then. And of course, you had a great tweet last night, too, where you said we just saw like 6 months of run up to the that we saw in the Iraq war that happened in like six hours. and that was true. I mean, it was amazing how quickly it progressed there. And I just kept thinking about, like, you know, everybody had their own reason why they had to do it, but it had to be done. And, you know,
It's like, what if we, I don't know. What if we had, what if the president had announced that we had captured Saddam Hussein, like, before they did any of the work of doing the groundwork for the invasion? Like, we'll come up with a reason later, but we have captured and killed Saddam Hussein.
Right. We did it. We invaded and let's
figure out why we did it in a few minutes.
Exactly. We're going to backfill this. I mean, nobody, that's the thing, is that, like, how do you get this guy all of a sudden? This is enemy, public enemy number one.
Yeah.
Nobody's heard of him.
Yeah. Like, they.
You got to build,
you got to make a case.
You got to do some pre-publicity for this rollout.
You got to manufacture some consent, people.
Exactly.
Don't you know how this stuff works?
Exactly.
That's what, honestly, that is what leads me to believe, at least, to believe it's plausible that this was a screw up in some way, because how do you not have Fox spending the last month telling everyone you got to hear about the Soleimani guy?
Of course. Right. Like, this is like doing the book tour 3 years after the book has been released or something. I mean, it's highly ineffective. All right. Kilmeade said Soleimani once on his decade.
In the last decade.
That's pretty good. When was it? January of 2018. Well, but if he said it really slow, it would lasted these 2 years.
The real heads remember.
I remember when he was talking about him that one time.
That once,
in January of 2018. It's always January.
I've been waiting.
I noticed about
someone. I've been waiting for someone to do something about that man.
He is an evil man every even year in January, starting in 2018.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your piece. I mean, I think to some extent we have.
Right? Yeah.
And, you know, it was funny because I spoke to Digby on the Friday before, and I was like, you know, we don't have time to go back over the past decade. Yeah. We don't have time to go back the past month. It's not even worth it. And somehow she brought it up because she had some thoughts that were very similar, I think, to some extent in terms of like the fecklessness.
Yeah.
Of, and I think your assessment is a little bit more on some level partisan on some level, mm-hmm. Because it's a failure of the left over that decade to hold the right to account and just sort of assuming that it's going to right itself.
Yes. Yeah.
And that is the same. And you're right. That's basically analogous to the way that we perceived like, oh, the banks will, we gotta give them the right idea and they'll go in the right way.
Yeah. Like we gotta, right. Like the idea that the world was saved after we stabilized financial markets. Like that was it. All right. We stabilized the financial markets by shoveling money at the banks. World saved. Like now we just got to wait for them to like reset up the system that was like not a big rickety mess beforehand. But like
and we'll give them some vague encouragement to help out homeowners.
Yeah. Yeah. While also right. Like that, and the entire story of the foreclosure crisis, too, is like they were that was the biggest example of them saying one thing and doing another.
Yep.
Because I think when you get to the defenses of the Obama presidency, it's a lot of like they did what was possible to achieve in the moment. That's the one where there's no defense for it. There's absolutely no defense for it. They were basically like spacing out foreclosures to help make sure the banks didn't get in too much trouble while actually not helping homeowners.
Right.
But I mean, yeah. But and then, you know, there was this idea that like once we got the smart people back in charge, the right would calm down and like what they, you know, they wanted to be the managers of like the liberal side of a power sharing agreement with sane right wing, basically. And it, you know, the right just got crazier and crazier as the decade went on.
I feel like if I put like a shaded part of this in red and part of it in blue, that this could be Joe Biden's campaign website in terms of like what he thinks is going to go forward.
Yes. Yeah.
Like it's exactly that.
Yeah.
Like we can just, if we just return to the norms.
Yeah.
Then everybody's going to play by the rules as if there was some like third party that came in and did this. Like now that the evil wizard is gone, who had cast the spell on everybody, all we need to do is get back to normal and everything will just be fine. And
it's going to break.
Delusion, yeah. Failure.
I mean, it's magical thinking. I guess it's because it's just what they want to happen. I mean, I don't know with someone like Biden. I think he's a very strong believer in himself. You know, I don't know how you get through the Obama presidency from the White House, dealing and believing yourself to have been the person best able to deal with Mitch McConnell, and look at your record of doing so,
right?
And actually believe you are the essential man, because I think he's sincere in that. I think he believes he's the essential man.
Yeah. I think it's just got to be the real problem that we have on some level is that there is a complete absence of stakes.
Yeah.
For all of these people.
Exactly.
And not just a complete absence of their own personal stakes, because, you know, I don't know what my personal stakes are necessarily. It's just being aware of the stakes that exist for other people.
Like, yes.
It's a question of like lack of personal stakes and a certain amount of sociopathy that just seems to permeate our elite. I mean, you know, this was all stuff that was written at the beginning of the decade.
I read a bunch of
Twilight of Elites, you know, Hayes's book.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Winner Take All Politics, I think, was the first book that we did on this show. And it was 9 years ago, probably, right at the beginning of the decade. Like there was this real awareness. Taibbi had written about the two different justice systems, essentially. Yep. Greenwald did the same thing. I mean, it was in the air, this notion, and Occupy.
Yeah.
It was in the air that this was going on, that there was just sort of like, there just was not enough depth of caring to to understand what was going on in the country.
Yeah, and I went back. I read a bunch of stuff from 2009, and you know, it was a very depressing experience to read a bunch of stuff from 2009 because there was this like completely. I mean, there was still optimism about what was going to get done over the next few years. There was.
Yep.
And I remember. So you know, there and I. I was reading my own magazine, The New Republic, which was run by a different regime 10 years ago.
Was that when Marty Peretz was?
I think it was right after Peretz, but it was owned by the dot-com billionaire who brought back Franklin Foer to run it.
Oh, was that Chris Hughes?
Yeah, Chris Hughes. Okay, yeah. Okay. So that was when Chris Hughes was running it.
Jeez, that was a long time ago.
But it still had a lot of the old Peretz guard. Like mm-hmm. the old guard, a lot of the old guard Peretz people were still there. But so it was a, you know, it was a neoliberal magazine. And then you know, there was sort of you had Jonathan Chait writing, and he often writes perceptibly about Republicans. And he wrote a feature about Republican nihilism and how it was the defining trait of the Republican Party at the moment. Well, absolutely true. But like the response to that then is, so what shall we do? what shall the opposition do?
That's the strange thing about Chait, because he could diagnose.
He can,
and then would just be like, and what we need is leeches.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
yes, exactly.
Like, saying, just like
exactly.
Like any type of actual response to, you know, like these people are absolutely insane. And what we need to do is go and sit down and have a sandwich with them or something. And
so then exercise the demons.
It's weird that he has that blind spot.
And then I read another piece that was, I think this one was a pretty famous one, but it was about Obama's nudgers, the sort of Cass Sunstein behavioral economics people who believed that government should be invisible and it should nudge people into good outcomes. And then within a few months, and you know, the New Republic liked to publish things that were in argument with each other, so it was not uncommon to see this. But within a few months of that, John Judas had a very great piece that basically said, like, Obama has dismissed the FDR's response to the Depression, but he shouldn't, and he needs to know that he needs to be building big things that people can visibly see to show that the government is capable of improving their lives. Like, that needs to be what he needs to be working on. And, like, they just believed the opposite of that. They literally believe the opposite of that. Government, like, my favorite example, I bring it up all the time, they gave people an invisible payroll tax cut and didn't talk about it on purpose. They gave every working American a tax cut. Purposely didn't talk about it because they believed that would encourage them to spend rather than save. There's behavioral economics for you. But like actual politics is Bush mailed everyone a check.
Yes, we all got
Bush
a check from George
mailed
Bush.
Everyone a check.
Yep.
And, you know, reading this John Judas thing from 2009, knowing how they were making healthcare, how they had done the stimulus, it's like really easy to be like, in addition to the racialized backlash, to be like, oh, that's how 2010 happened.
Yep.
There it is. That's how 2010 happened.
You know, it's interesting because I think in 2009, people probably still believed that. You know, when Barack Obama said, like, you know, he admired Reagan. I can't remember the exact quote, but the way that the hopeful interpreted that was that when Reagan said, like, you know, the government is the problem, that he was going to come out and show the government was the solution.
Yeah.
And but it the thing that Reagan did about that was simply communicate.
Yes.
That idea. I don't even know that he necessarily exercised it per se. I mean, they rolled back some a lot of environmental stuff and a lot of deregulation and whatnot. But it was the rhetorical. And Obama never did that. He never made the argument that government is beyond necessary. It is a positive in your life. It can do good things.
And, you know, the most hopeful way to interpret Obama saying that he admired Reagan would be to have believed he admired the way Reagan created a lasting and powerful political consensus around his movement and beliefs.
Yes.
But I, that was
but,
not,
what else could even, like, but even in retrospect, like what like, else,
what else, what did you,
what else,
I don't know. He liked the movies. Maybe
like he was the first actor and
he's really
I was
good
the
that,
first black president. That, like, I don't understand like what he was talking about at that point.
Yeah.
Did I mean, maybe he had, I don't know. I mean, the amazing thing is to look at Barack Obama now and just sort of see like, holy crap, man.
But the, like, Barack Obama, the lifestyle brand?
Yes.
It's depressing. And
it's really stunning.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand he had a rough go of it for 8 years. You know who else had a rough go of it? Was Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
I mean, and Jimmy Carter, I don't think was, I don't like his, particularly like his politics.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he was, I mean, he was a national joke for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And he responded by going out and basically building houses for homeless people for until like literally he can't even stand up.
Building houses for homeless people while also speaking out about his political principles in a way that has been more admirable than it was during his presidency.
I mean, you know, and I guess, I mean, this is relevant because Obama was really that decade, right? I mean, that's what Obama defined that decade. Can anybody point to a single thing that he has done that has been even like remotely like inspirational? Like, I'm trying to think of like, what has Obama done as president? I don't even care. Like, what has he projected that he's done?
Yeah.
That I could show my kid.
Yeah.
Like, and say, like, look, like nothing.
Favorite
right.
Books of each year and his favorite
song. No, I mean, I mean, it's really is pretty, like, I don't begrudge the guy. Like, you want to go.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, this is not like,
you know, a house in Martha Vineyard. I would like to buy a house in Martha Vineyard.
I don't have like, I don't have personal,
kid,
right.
Great.
I don't have personal expectations for him, but it is just, it's a good question.
But you would think that at least they would say like, we should do one thing that makes it look good. Like, you know, like, I mean, the Netflix thing, like the Netflix deal. I mean, what could I, you know, like I could show that to my daughter and say, look at this guy's 96 years old. He's out there with a hammer. He's still building houses.
Yeah.
I'm at a complete loss. And it's not like these guys don't have a platform for stuff. The only thing that I've like heard him do is say like, I'm going to really push back against Bernie.
Yeah.
if this whole Medicare for all thing gets out of hand, I'm going to step in.
Yeah.
I mean, but the problem is like, you know, the decade before that was a crap show.
Yeah.
The 90s were, I feel like, where people were just asleep and it was really just sort of like where the greed is good from the 80s became sort of just like, well, we don't even have to say it now.
Well, the 90s were like the last, maybe ever period of actually fairly widespread increasing economic fortune. It was
the end
actually
of history.
Yeah, it was. It was the end of history, but it was the last time in America that the rising tide actually lifted most boats. And like, you know, again, getting into the sort of economic history of it, it's just been bubbles based on credit ever since.
Right.
No wonder everyone is going insane.
Right.
Just like debt-backed economic bubbles like that just puncture every now and then.
All right. Well, let's we got some more stuff to some clips to look at, but let's talk a little bit about, I mean, I don't know what more to say about 2020. Yesterday on the program, I said like, look, you know, buckle up. Who knows? Like what I had said, and I think we got a call. I think Jeff from Georgia called in and was like basically saying like, are you afraid at all that the Republicans are going to do crazy ass shit over there? And I was like, vaguely, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't think it would happen in the next 7 hours. But I said yesterday that I mean, I think I can come up with all the scenarios of what could happen this year, right? Mm. Like Bernie wins. Biden wins. Warren wins. Trump wins.
Mm-hmm.
Trump has a heart attack. Pence wins.
Yeah.
You know, brokered convention. Even though I can sort of like predict the possible scenarios, I have no idea.
No.
Like, you know, like I have no idea like where it goes. It just seems to me like all options are on the table in a way that like I don't think we have any. I'm not convinced that, you know, impeachment is going to be radically different in 3 weeks than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
That the whole question is going to be radically different. That they're going to, you know, today The D.C. Circuit Court is looking at the question of whether Domagon has to testify. Yeah. There are more Mueller papers coming out right now. Who knows what's going on in the Southern District of New York? You know, there's all sorts of rumors about who backed some of these Deutsche Bank loans. Mm. I mean, six weeks out, I can't even say, like, I don't have any sense of it now. Like, I feel like we are in sort of uncharted territories, at least in my adult life.
Yeah. And I think, like, the last election that felt this completely up for grabs, especially, you know, I mean, there were, I guess, 2004, who knew who was going to win? Who knew if anyone was going to beat Bush? But, like, nothing, you know, I think since then, even if things have not gone the way we predicted, you could just sort of generally say, oh, that, like, that's sort of the way it's going to go. But there's too many variables this time.
Right.
There's just way too many variables.
Right.
It's crazy.
You guys need to be a little more optimistic. All right. Bernie's going to win. He's going to do health care with all of our help. But it's going to be, everything's going to be fine.
Even if Bernie wins, it's like, does that mean that Trump is going to leave?
Yeah, like, right. You know, like, what happens next?
Like what happened? Like, let's say Bernie won or whomever won, and that wasn't Trump.
I've been bested. I humbly give you the office.
Like, I, you know, people used to say, like, George Bush is not going to leave office. And, you know, I was like, no, I don't think so. But it seems perfectly conceivable to me that Bill Barr is going to be bringing lawsuits. And then... Yeah. You know, George Bush went painted. You know, Donald Trump is going to be trying to keep himself out of jail, or not. And his behavior, I don't know, it's going to be any different than it would otherwise. He's not going to go away.
No,
he doesn't leave the scene. The Republican Party, like, you know, like, this thing about Joe Biden's thing is so insane that nobody's really asked him about. Like, where do you think Donald Trump's going to go?
Donald Trump's going to buy a house in Martha's Vineyard and get a Netflix deal.
Right, get a Netflix deal and
disappear, except for his yearly end of the year list.
Everybody, here's the two books you should read. The Bible and The Art of the Deal. And that's it. Same as last year.
Favorite tweets to Twitter and reality TV, who will become delightful again.
But do you think that he's going to or do you think he's going to start a network? Do you think he's going to do something like that? Or do you think that, like, here's a guy who, there's still going to be 35% of the Republican Party that's going to want to put him on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
You know, or think that he's been martyred like Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And don't let them.
Well,
we just have to keep those people out of power and marginalized.
Well, I totally agree. But I mean, who knows what that's going to drive the Republican Party to do? And who knows? I mean,
because they're not crazy now.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that that crazy force is still going to exist. And I think it's going to be incredibly unpredictable. I mean, it's
The tweets, though, they'll be priceless.
They'll be great tweets. If Twitter even exists at that
time. Who knows?
Who knows? It could be a new thing.
Yeah.
It could be Twitter or something. I have no idea.
I hear the kids are using TikTok. I only know how to look at TikToks when they're on Twitter.
I've done a TikTok.
Do you think the president has ever seen a TikTok?
Have I not shown you the TikTok?
No. Wow, it's not for public consumption. Ahead of all of the millennials on this one.
It's music and choreographed and everything.
You saw it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't get it out of my head.
Wow. Did your daughter show you how to do that?
I did it with my daughter.
Yeah, that's nice. She's got an advantage because I'm an old millennial, so that I, like, TikToks are beyond me. I'm an old millennial, but, like, if you know, my kid is too young to be up on it yet.
That's right. Gen X's are that's a cool dad. Cool dad stuff is what's where it's at right now. We're going to do a Freebie Friday today. I couldn't be bothered. Just to make the nausea complete. Let's play Ari Fleischer here.
Ugh.
And then do we have audio of, or do we have that thing? Did you pull that from my tweet?
The quote?
Yeah. We don't have it as audio, right? We just have it written. Yeah, we do have it as...
as written.
Oh, as written. Okay. Here is Ari Fleischer with, God help us, Karl Rove on is this Chaffetz?
Yep.
Chaffetz is the one who couldn't look his teenage daughter in the eye, right? After about supporting Donald Trump, right?
Grabbed by the pussy, though.
Right. Here is here's Ari Fleischer. For folks who don't know, Ari Fleischer was George Bush's
first press secretary
during the invasion and occupation of the war of Iraq. And here he is now.
You know, I just remember when Osama bin Laden was killed and all Americans came together and cheered that event where the military was able to carry that action out. And I hope the same thing happens here with the death of Soleimani. He is the world's leading terrorist. He's been active with Hezbollah, with Hamas, within Yemen. And as Carl pointed out, he has blood on his hands from the killing of more than 600 Americans in Iraq. The other really important thing, though, Jason, to keep your eye on in terms of what comes next are the streets of Iran. You know, the Iranian people have been leading a revolution, a rebellion against their government, knowing what a dictatorship it is. It is one of the youngest, most pro-Western people throughout the Middle East, the Persian community in Iran. And I am very curious to see if they're going to celebrate this as well. Because, you know, many of those protests have said, end the Iranian aggression in other nations. Stop spending our Iranian money on these wars abroad, supporting terrorists. So I think it is entirely possible that this is going to be a catalyst inside Iran, where the people celebrate this killing of Soleimani and puts pressure on the Iranian government to stop its terrorism, to stop supporting all the various terrorist movements it has around the world.
All right, first of all, this is just bullshit.
It's just bullshit. It's bullshit.
In fact, it disempowers all of those people, according to the experts. But here is what
has historically been great for left-wing movements.
Here is Ari Fleischer. This is back in 2003, I think mid-March, right after the shock and awe and the initial invasion. Question, Ari, what we've been told about Saddam Hussein's regime, I think a lot of Americans are surprised that we haven't seen scenes of widespread jubilation, at least in some areas under coalition control. Why do you think that is? Fleischer says, well, let me remind, we saw in Afghanistan areas that had been removed from Taliban control. Why not Iraq? Well, let me remind you, what you saw in Afghanistan didn't happen on the fifth or sixth day. I mean, there's a certain amount of time here. The mission has only just begun. Saddam Hussein still has rather lethal pockets of resistance that have been left behind at different places. And the presence of those forces has still created some fear in the Iraqi people, which is justifiable given the way that Saddam Hussein's military forces and security forces have treated people who spoke out or showed their desire to be free from Saddam's oppression. So we already have seen, indeed, in some areas, and I've seen in many of your newspapers and magazine pictures of jubilant Iraqis. Of course, there was a picture of an Iraqi attacking a picture of Saddam Hussein with a shoe that was widely disseminated around the world. People saw that. So I think you have seen it. I suspect as the security situation becomes more stable in all these areas, you'll see more of it. This guy, just regardless of what the situation is, like Soleimani was not a domestic oppressor of Iranians.
Yeah.
He was like their Eisenhower before he was president.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And they think that they're going to be jubilant in the streets of Iran.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't even make any sense in his own logic.
No. And again, like, I guess I brought up reality-based community earlier, and when you saying not everyone might remember Ari Fleischer makes me realize, my God. But yes, that was a quote from the Bush administration in which they were like, well, you go ahead, like, with an anonymous Bush official in New York Times Magazine, was like, go ahead and like use your facts and logic on us. Like,
right.
We make our own reality.
Yep.
But Ari Fleischer, exactly like I was saying before, I think he is cynical enough to basically know what he's saying is bullshit, except in the sense that like he probably backs some opposition groups that would welcome Americans destabilizing the government. But like, I actually just saw a Iranian reformist MP, Saleh Shouri, who has called Iran a dictatorship, tweeted a tweet this morning mourning Soleimani, like mourning him, calling him a brave and courageous commander. That's the opposition. That's right. The moderate opposition in Iran. And politically and possibly just out of patriotism, the moderates are saying, like, Soleimani was a hero.
And let's be clear, when we say moderates, what we're saying is they want rapprochement with the West.
Yes.
At least towards that.
Yes, exactly.
And so if theoretically we want that, that person has now been disempowered because the West just killed one of their sort of like, you know, heroes, essentially.
Yeah.
Here's Mike Pompeo desperately trying to sell this war or I mean, look, this is an act of war that we perpetrated. There's no other way of saying it.
Exactly.
And so it may not, the war may just continue, you know, sort of submerged as a proxy war, or it may break out as a full on war. We're not sure yet. We will find out soon enough. But here's Mike Pompeo trying to justify it to the United States of to the country. And it seems like they had no idea about this a week ago.
You put out a statement a short time ago that says the decision to eliminate General Soleimani was in response to imminent threats to American lives. What was the nature of those imminent threats?
John, I can't talk too much about the nature of the threats, but the American people should know that President Trump's decision to remove Qasem Soleimani from the battlefield saved American lives. There's no doubt about that. He was actively plotting in the region to take actions, a big action as he described it, that would have put dozens, if not hundreds, of American lives at risk. We know it was imminent. This was an intelligence-based assessment that drove our decision-making process. The American people also know the history of Qasem Soleimani, hundreds of American lives on his hands, too. He was involved in the Beirut bombings. He'd orchestrated an attack right here in Washington, D.C. It ultimately failed. This is a man who's put American lives at risk for an awfully long time. And last night was the time that we needed to strike to make sure that this imminent attack that he was working actively was disrupted.
A specific target overseas?
I'm not going to say anything more about the nature of the attack, but know that this was not just in Iraq. It was throughout the region. It was using these proxy forces that he has manipulated for so long to bring so much destruction to the Shias and Sunnis, the Muslims throughout the region. This is a man who inflicted enormous harm not only on American lives, but created terribly destructive activities supporting Lebanese Hezbollah, Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, all of the bad actors in the Middle East. Qasem Soleimani was at the center of all of it.
Was there any imminent threat to the U.S. homeland?
These were threats that were located in the region.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I love that phrase, actively plotting.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the plan was not finished yet.
Right.
But they were actively plotting.
Yeah, they hadn't figured out the last bit.
They weren't planning quite yet.
Yeah.
They were plotting.
Plotting.
They hadn't finished the plot.
Yeah.
To move on to the plan. They were actively plotting. They were saying,
the first act of the plot.
Wouldn't it be good if something bad happened to Americans in the region through our affiliates?
I hope we have intelligence that Soleimani did all the planning by himself and didn't write anything down or tell anyone about
it. That would be super. That would be awesome.
That would be helpful.
Well, that's why they had to get him now.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he was still in the plotting stage.
He was about to write a memo explaining the plot.
Unbelievable. I don't see how they think this is going to work. I really don't.
Pompeo's so bad at this. He doesn't breathe properly to media appearances. He's always trying to catch his breath.
Look at this. Look at just another example of how unprepared they were for this. This is the Defense Department statement. Look at this. Put up this Defense Department statement. Soleimani. Statement by the Department of Defense. At the direction of the president, the U.S. military has taken the defensive action to protect U.S. personnel abroad by killing Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, CUD Force, a U.S.-designated foreign terrorist organization. Will you Google the IRGC for me, please, and put that up on the screen? This is Google, ladies and gentlemen, available to non-Defense Department personnel. Yeah. Okay, there it is. What is it called there?
It's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Can we see what the Defense Department, who just assassinated this man, thinks it's called? Like, our own Department of Defense.
Yeah.
This is...
They weren't... Right.
They didn't know what organization that he led. Like, the number one terrorist that all Americans are worried about in our own Defense Department doesn't know the first word of the organization that he represented, that he led.
And
seems bad. Clearly, I don't know.
They clearly had, you know, obviously because this decision was made carefully. They
measured.
They must have had plenty of time to write the statement.
Right.
Hey, boss, I just wrote this down. Anybody want to check it? We don't have time.
It's basically a tweet, that statement.
Right. No, I don't have time. You know, and spell check didn't change it, so yeah. Must be all right. Yeah, exactly.
They wouldn't leave an opportunity to stress Islamic on the table if they knew about it.
Yeah, exactly. They would have left Islamic in
Big
there if
time.
They'd known.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. All right, lastly, let's just do this. Stuart Varney, God bless his soul. Stuart Varney, do we have the images of what was going on when Clinton was impeached? Do we have those? You'll see this. We can just Google it, but not only when Clinton, and I'm not convinced that he didn't launch those attacks, frankly. Was it the attacks on the what was supposedly in Libya a place where they were creating some type of biological warfare or something like that? I believe
Sudan. I think it was.
Was it Sudan or and it turned out to be like a pharmaceutical place,
right?
Yeah.
I think that's what happened during the
pharmaceutical.
And I think this happened in 1998. So I suspect it was that 98.
Yeah.
I think this is what was launched during. The Clinton during the impeachment, the attack took place a week after the Monica Lewinsky scandal and 2 months after the film Wag the Dog. But when he was engaged in this, the Republicans who were simultaneously impeaching him said that he has to resign because of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Never mind that he can't be impeached, that the impeachment should be just bypassed and he should automatically resign. Yeah. Maybe Stuart Varney is just too young to remember that.
The political side is, what did the Democrats do with this? Most of them have come out and said, yeah, Soleimani was a bad guy. He deserved what he got, but we were reckless in taking him out. That was the word used by Senator Elizabeth Warren. The Democrats are in the position of looking like they're saying, be cautious about going after a terror state and a clear enemy of America. That's a difficult political row to hoe. Where does it leave impeachment?
Mm-hmm.
Are we now going to try to impeach and remove from office the commander-in-chief who's just taken out one of the world's leading terrorists?
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a question, I suggest. No answers at this point. Frankly, I'm waiting to see how President Trump phrases his reaction to this news.
When Stuart Varney says something like that, I get the feeling that he is like, they're, people are sitting around like, Stuart, you're supposed to put it in your own words.
Right? Yeah.
Like now everybody, because that's the template. Dude.
Right.
That's,
like,
not...
that's just like, you got to sort of embellish on it. Right. You got to rephrase it a little bit.
Now what's Hannity going to say?
Yeah. I don't really know what you say to. Yeah, he almost correctly diagnosed a problem with the Democrats' rhetoric, though. Yeah, I give him credit for that.
No, that is what I was complaining about. Yeah. You cannot accept the predicate about Soleimani because it's irrelevant to the question. But you get the sense that maybe that is just the whole kit and caboodle right there. They're hoping this continues to escalate, that this is like an ongoing tit for tat over the course of the next 6 to 8 months. And Democrats, they go on to CNN, they go on to MSNBC, to the extent that they go on Fox, and they go like, are you really looking to get rid of a president in the middle of this like ongoing,
conflict,
this war that he started?
Conflict, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. That's what it sort of feels like to me, but.
It's so naked what they're doing, though. I just think it's not going to work.
I think there is a big difference between now and then. At the very least, just even social media. I think there's a big difference in all the other platforms for media.
I think on the one hand, it's incredibly distressing that 99% of elected Democrats are still going with sort of accepting the premises that led to the forever war. But it is meaningful that one of the leading presidential candidates is like the only one willing to plainly say just pointlessly ramping up war over there will have negative consequences.
I'm really curious. Like, I like to think that this is going to help Bernie, and I think it might, but
I hope against hope that this will appeal to the better angels of people's nature. And, you know, it's getting harder and harder to distract people from the fact that capitalism is on fire and their lives are kind of crappy. And Bernie speaks to that.
I think another effect of this is really going to be to like further alienate a lot of people who are paying attention from the Democratic leadership, though. Like, and just in there again. So I don't know if I just saw this, but like,
is this the Schumer? Schumer? Yeah. Chuck Schumer is well, Chuck Schumer still like, is he?
Yeah.
Still,
what is?
He still in the Senate?
Schumer said there's the news story that Schumer was not given advance notice of the airstrikes. Dinesh D'Souza said neither were the Iranians, and for pretty much the same reason. Like, ha ha ha, great joke.
Right.
The president retweeted that. I'm saying like the cautious rhetoric on the one hand, that's how it's responded to, right? Like Schumer believes, I don't know what he still believes, but he does not openly and publicly oppose Donald Trump and the administration, possibly in the belief that like he doesn't want to prod the bear and thus not be able to negotiate with them or something. But they're retweeting Dinesh D'Souza, equating him with our foreign enemies.
Yeah, this idea that somehow like we're gonna appeal to the rational people, like it's just it is. It's absurd. I mean, Chuck Schumer should come out there and say, this is insanity.
Yes.
Period.
Yeah.
Period.
There's no strategy. We don't know what we're doing. We don't know what they're going to do next. Like, there's clearly no strategy. It's just...
There should be hearings.
Yes.
There should be hearings. I know Chuck Schumer's in the Senate and he has no power.
Right.
But he should go meet with the Baileys, see what the Baileys say. He should be calling on Nancy Pelosi to have hearings. He should be calling Nancy Pelosi... private, say, have hearings. If you don't, I'm coming out and saying that you should have hearings.
Yeah.
Well, some of these people probably wanted to go to war with the
absolutely.
They just don't like the way Trump's doing it.
Some of them probably are fine with it. Bob Menendez probably has no problem with this.
I think it's quite possible that Chuck Schumer doesn't have a problem.
Well, that's a huge political problem that there's no way in hell a majority of people who vote for Democrats want any of this to be happening. And yet... that idea is almost invisible in the Democratic Party leadership. Like, how sustainable is that? That's insane.
That's the thing I'm really curious to find out if this ends up really helping Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
It's going to be fascinating to see. I suspect it might. I mean, my initial reaction was like, is this going to help Biden? But I just don't think so, because on some level, like... I think the people who think that Biden is like a stable force have already decided that Biden's a stable force.
Yeah, they've already decided it.
I don't think people are, if anything, I think this makes it a little bit more shaky.
Yeah.
Well, think about how her vote on the Iraq war hurt Hillary last time around. And Trump, too, liked to brag about, I mean, he's a crazy person and there's no evidence that he's right about anything, but he said, I was against Iraq. It was a terrible idea.
And he
was.
He went up. I mean, that was a remarkable thing. People forget. So he went up on the Republican debate stage and berated each of them for supporting the Iraq war, regardless of the fact that whether or not he did so at the time doesn't even matter. It just showed politically.
Yep.
There was no absolutely like it was the right call at the time to have been against the war or to say you were against the war.
And nothing's changed.
Well, this is why I also said, in a tweet last night, that like what Democrats actually want, and they stripped from the defense authorization bill. They stripped the language that would have prevented a war with Iran, and they stripped language.
Who stripped that?
I think Pelosi was one who allowed it to go out of committee without that language. But I'm not actually. I don't remember the entire like TikTok on that.
Yeah, Ro Khanna was tweeting about
that. Yeah.
And I think I saw some people saying, like, names.
Right.
Yeah. Please.
Yeah.
Like these things, like, you know,
I mean,
the way things get stripped out of, but that's the difference, is that 20 years ago, now again, there's no 9/11, which right. would have changed the situation entirely, which you know, intimidated a lot of people, but there's, you know, there's a dozen, maybe more of like sort of fairly well-known Democrats who are going to come out against this from the get-go.
And there were, you know...
And there's a lot of primary challengers, too, yes. who are pushing on.
And like 20 years ago, you know, the people who would have been against war would have been treated as a joke. In Congress, I mean.
Yes.
Sanders, Kucinich, like yep. those types were not taken seriously by anyone. I would not be surprised if the lesson some elected Democrats have taken from all of that is that you should allow the war you want to happen without having to vote in favor of it.
Right. No vote. Yes, that is. I mean, that happens pretty often. All right. Let's just play this one clip of there's been raging fires. I don't know if we have really any footage of fires from and I don't know that really it does any justice. I mean,
I think it's impossible to imagine the scale of these fires based on how large they're.
There's something like over 11 million acres on fire. Like I saw images of people on a beach because that was the safest place they could be.
Oh, yeah.
And that's nuts. I mean, because, you know, this is a country for the most part, which is more or less, you know, I mean, obviously there's people who live in the interior of the country, but it would be basically like we just have coastal, see, I mean, you can drive basically into the center of Australia and get to like a, you know, like a, basically a truck stop.
Right.
And that's, you know, one of the biggest,
but yeah, the majority of people live around the,
yeah, the vast coast, majority yeah. of people. And of course, like, you know, the indigenous folks in Australia are paying the biggest price, of course, which is, you know, sort of, I think what we're going to see with, largely with climate change, but the average temperature last year across the entire country was something like 107 degrees.
Jeez.
Like the average temperature.
Yeah.
Now, a big chunk of the country is desert.
Right. Yeah, but still. Like,
I spent 3 weeks out there in a tent.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. The water had washed away the road to Adelaide, and all I had was Hannah Arendt's The Banality of Evil. It was a dark time for me.
That sounds like it.
But here is folks in Cobargo, and I don't know where Cobargo is, but it's inland, obviously. But and you can see how arid it is, and the PM, the Prime Minister. Now they have the Australian government has been in denial about climate change.
Yeah,
rivaled only by ours, I think, on some level, at least now. And they get met by the Prime Minister comes in and basically the folks there just they won't even shake the guy's hand.
And we should just note they call him he's a member of the Liberal Party. That's the right wing party in Australia's parliament.
And OK, so this Cobargo is not even that far inland as far as it goes. It's on the. And I get confused here. But it's between Sydney and Melbourne. So it's on the East Coast. And, you know, this is like the more populated, relatively speaking. This is only like, I don't know how many hours from Canberra, but probably not more than like four, if that much. Maybe a little bit less. And it shows up here. They're relatively close to the beach. I mean, you know, they're relatively close to the coast. And here's this.
How are you? How are you? I'm only shaking your hand if you give more funding to our RFS. So many people here have lost their homes.
We need some beds.
We need more help.
You won't be getting any votes down here, buddy.
You're an idiot.
Who votes liberal around here? Nobody. No liberal votes. You're out, son. You are out. Good night, Melina.
See you, mate. Bye.
Go, I'm pissed off.
What about the people?
What about the people who have nowhere to live? You're not welcome. The
point
is that... Go on, get to Kirribilli.
What?
We might burn that down.
Thing, you moron.
I don't see Kirribilli burning after the fireworks.
Boomer! This is not fair. We are totally forgotten about down here. Every single time this area has a flood or a fire, we get nothing. If we were Sydney, if we were North Coast, we would be flooded with donations, with urgent emergency relief. Fall down!
Scumbag!
They just basically chased him off.
I want to hear what they bleeped out.
I know it.
Australians are so good at
incredibly obscure Australian.
So well.
That's one of the most depressing things about American political culture is that the leader of our state never has that happen to them.
It's
seriously
true.
Like you paid attention to the UK election too. Boris Johnson just walking around having old pensioners yell insults at him.
I wonder when that flipped, because we like used to tar and feather people.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, I mean it absolutely. Probably after a couple assassinations.
Maybe it's time to bring it back.
I talked about that last time I was here with Andrew Johnson. When he went on his little tour around the country, people were heckling him constantly.
Right.
People were just heckling.
They were either throwing vegetables.
They were throwing vegetables at him.
Well, Trump gets booed at sporting events.
That's the closest. And then they stopped sending him. Like, we just don't, our presidents just don't ever interact with non-handpicked crowds.
Bring
right.
back the tar and the feathers.
Let's take some phone calls, shall we? We got a little bit of time. You got some time?
Oh, yeah, I got
a couple calls.
Yeah.
Calling from a 509 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 509?
It's Sam.
Yeah.
It's Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan, happy 2020 to you.
Thank you. Same. Likewise. I'm trying to square a circle here. You seem to be pretty anti-war. And yet yesterday you came out pretty vociferously in favor of human genocide for food. And
we had a call from a vegan yesterday who said was trying to make the point, like, if I could imagine a post-apocalyptic era where we would eat other human beings, would I be okay with factory farming of humans? Mm-hmm. But I can't have the mindset of I would have then. I need to have that mindset of now.
Right. You need to believe that.
I mean, in other words, philosophy.
Yes.
Okay, yes, I understand your point, I think.
Well, first of all, Sam also pretended like he didn't know what morality was, which kind of made it, you know, confusing. But, Sam, do you drive a car anywhere?
I do, yes, on occasion.
What if, you know, the Flintstones, how, like, the cars are powered by people?
Yeah, I do. They walk, right? Sure. Okay, I understand.
Right. So what if instead of cars, we had Flintstone cars, but it was slaves who had to move your car around? Would that be okay?
Well, no.
I'll use your language, I guess. That wouldn't be your preference.
Right, that wouldn't be my preference.
Okay, so what about the first situation would need to change to make it enough like the second situation for you to be not in favor of the first situation?
Well,
careful now, because I don't want you to get quite as owned as you got yesterday. To get owned that hard, frankly, 2 days in a row would be unfair to you. So I'm going to, you know, give you a little bit of leeway.
Okay. So what would make the first situation as unpreferential as the second situation? That would be if a slave drove my car today. I would not want a slave. I would not want slaves.
Now, you like apples, I understand. But what if instead of pulling apples off of a apple tree, it was human heads? You had to sever a head off of a human. And for every apple, you know, it was actually a head that was coming off a tree of people. The people are like tied to the branches.
Right.
Kind of confusing, but...
Would
you still be enthusiastically in support of apples and apple farming?
Probably not, no.
That's what I thought.
All right, well, okay. I guess we're going to have to clip this. I got owned 2 days in a row, so... Thanks, Ronald Reagan. 2020 is already starting off to be a little bit rough. He just hung up.
Flintstones already had slaves.
Let's go to a 210.
That one was
easier
to follow, actually.
Yeah, it was actually. It made more sense. Calling from 210 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Good afternoon, Sam, and Happy New Year to you and the crew.
John from San Antonio. It's everybody's coming back for the New Year. It's good to hear everybody's coming back in 2020.
Yeah, I'm happy, very happy that you're considering covering Democratic caucuses and primaries live.
I think we're going
to. Good. I appreciate you having me on the election coverage in 2016 and 18. I'd love to do again.
Well, I think we will.
So, great. So, Bernie Sanders hauled in 34.5 million in the last quarter, easily surpassing the second highest fundraiser by almost $10 million. And Bernie supporters have a lot of reasons for optimism. He's leading in polling in Iowa, New Hampshire, and California is also leading in those states. And American prediction market websites and British markets, betting markets, yeah. So since the emergence of Bernie in 2016 election, the left has been ascendant. Hopefully 2020 will show the newly emergent strength of the left in electoral politics. It's 60 days till Super Tuesday, which will host 5 House and senatorial primaries in California, Texas, North Carolina, Alabama, and Arkansas. There are 24 strong progressives running in California for House seats, 10 in Texas, and 5 in North Carolina. Out of the 43 seats that flipped to the Democrats in 2018, almost all were won by centrist or conservative Democrats. Young Turk CEO Cenk Uygur has challenged the premise that progressives can't flip districts. So he's now running in the 25th District of California, where centrist Democrat Katie Hill recently resigned. Cenk has excellent fundraising so far. There's actually 2 separate elections on March 3rd in the 25th District. One is for the vacant seat that'll serve from the next time there's a winner, which will probably be from May till the end of this year. And the regular election will hold its jungle primary, in which the candidates will from all parties will compete against each other for the top 2 seats in November. In the race for 2020, Cenk Uygur's main competition comes from centrist Democrat Christy Smith, who serves in the California Assembly, and David Rednick is also running as a Democrat. Cult of Trump Party are vying for the seat, and 6 Cult of Trump parties are vying for the seat, with former Congressman Steve Knight, who served 2 terms in this district before losing to Katie Hill by 9 points in 2014. Cult of Trump Party Mike Garcia raised $480,000 in the third quarter, and that may split the Republican vote. In the race for the 2020 representation, the winner must get over 50% of the vote, which is highly unlikely. So there'll probably be a runoff on May 12th between the top 2 vote getters in the general election for the term starting in 2021. There are 13 candidates, six Democrats and six cult of Trump parties with one no party preference.
That's a new rhetorical flourish from you, John. I don't think I've heard you say cult of Republican of cult of Trump party.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's pretty obvious, so, yeah. Okay. Okay. In the Texas 28th District, Justice Democrat endorsed Jessica Cisneros as challenging one of the worst Democrats in the House in the 21st century, Henry Cuellar. According to 538, that Trump's score, which is incomplete but gives a general idea of voting patterns, Cuellar votes with Trump 46% of the time, which is the second worst voting record in the Democratic Party. Cisneros is an immigration lawyer. You interviewed her on Ring of Fire, right?
I think so. Let me just ask you this. There's no polling in any of these districts, right? I mean, we have a dearth of polling, it seems to me, this year. Like Iowa, we haven't seen nearly as many polls as we did 4 years ago. 4 years ago, right?
That's exactly right. It was even more in 2007. You know, I mean, of course, they were holding their primary.
So,
right
what are
the
implications
of
this, John? I mean, what are the implications in terms of like what you know? I mean, I imagine from a in terms of the national races, but with the states, do we have a less clear picture of where everybody stands at this point? I mean, like Iowa, it seems to me at this time, by this time, I think maybe the primary relative to when the primary was, there was like between a half a dozen and a dozen polls. And now there's like two, it feels like.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think mainly it's because it just costs so much money. Because of the emergence of smartphones, you know, and people don't answer their phones and people, you know, are just people don't want to the organizations just don't want to do it. I mean, local organizations don't want to poll. National organizations don't want to poll. I mean, I'm hoping to see more, you know, but I mean, at the same time, you know, I think that I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing for Bernie because.
Well, presumably,
you know,
the campaigns themselves
are paying for
polls. And if you've got that much more money, you're Bernie, you've got the most amount of money, you are getting the polls. And so theoretically, you have the best amount of information. And for a campaign like Bernie's, which is so organizing based. Mm-hmm. And I think The Intercept has a piece about this, actually, that came out today. One would expect that would be, I don't know how big of an advantage, but an advantage at least, right?
Yeah. I mean, Ben Tolshan is his pollster and, you know, he's a pretty good pollster and he hasn't released any, he released a bunch of, some polls, in Midwest states, I think in, last summer or maybe it was last spring, and I haven't seen anything for public release since then. I mean, it's just, you know, he's so issue oriented that I think that you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing for him, but I mean, obviously, you know, if he's polling well, it's going to help him. But so I'm just curious. I know you're saying that it's hard to know about you know, what's going to happen in 2020. But I mean, like in October, you know, obviously it was kind of a bad month for Bernie with the heart attack. And, you know, Warren was dropping in the polls. All the big money advocates were attacking the electability of progressives. And, you know, Bernie came back in November and he hasn't really looked back. So, you know, right now he's, you know, 3-1 in British betting markets to win the nomination. So, you know, how do you see the state of progressives, you know, in the presidential and House elections?
I don't know. I think the upshot, all I can tell you is this. My sense is that incumbents are more attuned to their primary challenges, that there are a lot more primary challenges than we've seen in the past, that I suspect it's also impacting their behavior on some level. I, you know, and I've interviewed, I think, you know, we ran, I think I've interviewed now about 15 or so primary challengers, Democratic primary challengers, because I've really become much more of a believer. I've always believed that there should be primaries, but I almost am now at the point where I think they're absolutely necessary, even amongst the best, even my favorite candidates. For the most part, a primary challenge is a good thing from the left anyways. And I have to say that like half of them I thought were excellent, like relative to even, you know, sit in terms of their ability to communicate why they're running. You know, it's impossible for me to know whether they are, you know, what kind of ground game they have. And but there's a model that AOC created, and you know, primaries I think favor a progressive candidate who is actually, you know, like a quality candidate. So we'll see. I don't think you're going to win the majority of them, but I think it's going to impact. I think it functions as a disciplining device. I mean, you know, ask Lindsey Graham, frankly. Appreciate the call, John. Looking forward to more in 2020.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sam. Take care.
We get time for a couple more calls. Calling from an 801 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Is this me?
Yes, it is.
Awesome. This is TJ from Utah.
PJ from Utah? Welcome to the
TJ. I just got two quick things. One, not to be a conspiracy theorist, but you mentioned earlier about, you know, Iran possibly attacking the grid. Right before the show came on, I had a power outage in my area. And when I checked Rocky Mountains Power, their website, to check for outages, there were a ton throughout the Wasatch Valley. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I don't know.
I suspect that would not be the first place that they do the power outage.
It seems unlikely,
the Iranians can do is to get it covered on the majority report, it's not going to be.
One other thing. So the Utah primary is open to literally anyone. You can be registered to any party. And I believe if you go into your local county government building before the 10th, you can sign up to get a mail-in primary. So do that if you live in Utah.
Okay. Yeah. Do that if you live in Utah. Appreciate the call, DJ. Thanks.
No problem. Have a good day.
Everybody should be making sure they're registered to vote in the primaries.
Yes, absolutely.
Do it now.
Yeah.
Because I don't know where the date is. I don't know where you live, per se.
The rules are different in every state, too.
Well, let me get your take on New York over the past week has basically come to a deal about getting rid of cash bail for misdemeanors. I don't know if you followed this.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Misdemeanors and nonviolent offenses, basically coming out of a story of a guy who stole a backpack.
Yeah.
Had $3,000 or $6,000 bail.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get out of jail for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when he finally got out, he committed suicide. Yeah. And there's also, by the end of the year, evictions were down by like 35,000 people in New York State. Just give me your sense of a new, because I'm quite convinced that like the untold story of New York State is Cynthia Nixon should be getting a lot more credit than she did.
Yeah. And I think that's true. And a lot of this is happening as the sort of main political figures in New York in terms of power and how well known they are not thrilled about any of this, but just sort of have to let a lot of it go through.
Yep.
Right. And I think like it was huge and dramatic, not just that the Democrats finally took control of the entire state legislature, but the ones who did actually had an appetite for doing stuff, which I think is not, it's easy to imagine another scenario where typical New York machine Democrats had taken control of the Senate and done nothing.
And just remind people, there was this thing, this caucus.
Yeah, the IDC, Independent Democratic
Caucus.
And
basically Republicans. And Cynthia Nixon, I think, raised awareness about it.
So that, I think that's the biggest thing she did was that. I had been yelling about the IDC. No one, you know, and New York has incredibly restrictive rules about how long before an election you have to register. It's all these rules designed to make it difficult, especially for people who are
not insurgent campaigns.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you want to bring in a bunch of new votes for your primary campaign, the law just doesn't let you do it. People who had been shouting about the IDC, which had been in a power sharing agreement with Republicans, basically out of this sort of long running handshake deal that the assembly belonged to Democrats and the state Senate belonged to Republicans, as New York voters kept being like, we would like Democrats to be in charge.
Right. And this was also, this is midwife by Andrew Cuomo, who did not want to be put in a position
where
of having to sign legislation that he felt was too far to the left.
Exactly. His entire, and it, you know, he did this out of, it's a political conviction that he shares with a lot of other Democrats in, like, as reality has shifted to disprove it. Like, reality has shifted to disprove it, but Cuomo has a political theory that he cannot drop, and it's very related to Chuck Schumer and the Baileys, which is that, like, for a Democrat like him to win, he needs basically Long Island moderates, and he can't let the Democrats get too liberal. And, you know, on the other hand, like, New York voters have been trying to be like, we want to be more like California. We just want liberals in charge. And but Cuomo still believes that, nope, they're going to go too far. And, you know, so basically, by raising awareness of the IDC and making voters actually know what it was, that allowed these anti-IDC campaigns to get a lot of traction and basically boot the entire, almost the entire IDC out of the state Senate. And that was huge. Like, not just the Democratic majority, but the fact that the Democratic majority was not made up in large part of these assholes.
and so now we're starting to see that the legislation that is,
that is actually going through that. Stuff that Cuomo would have been like, oh, I wish we could have had better rent regulation,
right,
but just couldn't get it through the Senate.
Why do you think we don't have legalized pot?
I don't know. That's the one where I ask myself this all the time. And it's like, I think
all the time. Huh?
Yeah. I mean, just out of, you know, just for political reasons, I ask
of
all
course.
The time.
It's, you're a political writer.
Yeah. Because this it really seems to sum up all of the political fears of a particular generation of Democrats. I think it's just like what we were talking about before. Law and order, tough on crime, moral panic about drugs. It's they absolutely believe that you know, the cities were out of control. Like, they're literally stuck in a political framework that is completely out of date and believe that if they legalize marijuana, like, a high person is going to shoot someone, and politicians who let this person get marijuana will be blamed.
Reefer madness.
Yeah, it's I mean, it is.
Michael Savage.
All the backwater ass places that have recreational marijuana before us makes me so angry.
Yeah, Illinois just made it legal.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell?
Michael Savage wrote, you know, tweeted out something the other day, like, a buddy of mine from New York says, you know, New York City is a pit now. Like, people are, everything smells like pot and they're blowing it. And it's almost like that's taken to heart. Like,
yeah.
When I was contemplating quitting law school, I was like, I'm going to quit smoking too. Like, I'm going to balance off this sort of, like, you know, irresponsible thing
with something responsible. Yeah.
And, I mean, of course, I did not. I ended up smoking quite more heavily for an extended period of time. But
I'm shocked to hear that after you.
It was the same sort of theory. It's like, we can't, this pot thing, like, we can do rank control, but we can't, not if people are getting high everywhere.
It's a fear of backlash. It really is.
I also think there's, like, I feel like Andrew Cuomo is trying to figure out a way.
Trying to figure out an angle.
Yeah. Like, how am I going to get paid?
He needs, because that's the other part of it. Like, if someone connected to him was able to make it lucrative for him, like, it would be happening.
I sort of feel like that.
Which I have to imagine Illinois worked the same way. Like, when they finally got it through, I really have to
Without
imagine.
Without a doubt, I would imagine. All right, we got time for one or two more calls. Call from a 551 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, Sam. It's A-Square.
A-Square, how are you? Happy 2020.
How are you? Happy 2020. Happy New Year, Jamie, Matt, Brandon, and, of course, Mike Brooks. Mike, that show with the guy from Wildfire,
was fantastic.
He's not
talking
here.
Talking about spirituality. Oh, he's not there.
No,
oh.
He's not. He's contractually prevented from working a full week in 2020 until the second half of January.
But if you have anything nice to say about the Antifada or Literary Hangover, Matt and I are here.
Well, of course. Of course. I'm sorry. I joined late, and I was trying to do my annual call at the end of the year, and I couldn't. I just wanted to say to all of you, thanks so much for keeping us sane. And this year is going to be hell. Sam, it's like they put us in a freaking time machine, and it's 2002, 2003 when I woke up this morning. What the hell is going on with these people?
I don't know.
They're going to do this all over again.
I don't think that they're going to be able to do it over.
It's not going to work the same.
It's not going to work the same way. And I think
that's
the nature of the era, and that they didn't. It was lazy about it.
Yeah.
Right?
It's just unbelievable. It's unbelievable. We didn't have a hard year ahead of us already. Mm-hmm. Listen, here's something that I wanted to throw at all of you and I think and your guests too to consider. And so I'm going to hang up after that so you can talk about it now or later. You remember after the election, the re-election of Obama and the what was that? Autopsy report the Republicans were going to do, and all of the fears that existed out there about the split of the Republican Party. I have to tell you, I feel that way about the Democratic Party now. If Bernie Sanders is not on this ticket, I just think that it just seems to me like the progressives are going to say enough with the Democratic Party. As much as it's hard to wield power without a machine in this country, I just don't know. So one of the things that I wanted you to see if you can find a guest to talk about whether the progressive wing of the party could start lifting a machine. And I know, Jamie, you're going to say socialism now, and I agree, but I just think that the way the political power is configured in this country, you need a machine. And so I'm concerned that the party's going to split and the progressives are going to say the hell with this and try to establish something, but not having enough money and power to get it to happen. So with that, I'm going to say I will be listening and hope to see you guys in November, bring you a bottle of champagne. We win any which way with the anniversary of Majority Report. Oh, thank you, Sam.
Thank you, A Squared. Appreciate it.
Bye.
What I should tell you, thank you, A Squared. We figured out about a month ago that the 10-year anniversary of the show is on Election Day.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
What do you think? I mean, like, do you think that if Sanders is not, I mean, assuming that it happens without any type of, like, major irregularity, right?
Sure.
Like, I mean, put aside for the moment a brokered convention where, like, on the third ballot, you know, all of a sudden Pete Buttigieg, you know, like, you know, does, you know, is somehow pulls, like, some parliamentary trick and, you know, Joe Biden becomes a nominee or something like that.
This hypothetical is already making me mad.
Well, but just I'm curious as to what you think. Is there a scenario where I don't think it's realistic that there's going to be a, you know, create a third party. But I mean, how tough of a divide do you think there would be going either way? Because I think it's, you know, I mean, I personally think that Bloomberg has just bought himself an option to run as a third party candidate.
Yeah.
And he's going to make that decision after the convention.
Well, you know, my impression with people like Bloomberg was that what they were trying to do sort of was recognize that this was a moment in which people like him could sort of take control of the Democratic Party, basically, right? Because there is a sort of natural split between, you know, with a party that still has a large working class base, primarily made up of people of color, and on the other hand, has a large and increasing base of educated, well-off moderates, but not even necessarily moderates. Sometimes they're very, very liberal people, but they're sort of educated and well-off people. That's not a sort of completely natural coalition, right? So I think that the way, if you're looking at it from a Bloomberg perspective, there's a pretty obvious way to cleave that, take control of the wealthier part of it, and then, like, sort of, I mean, there's no, like, completely natural like the party coalitions are not a creation of God, right? They're like the Democratic Party especially is just like a bunch of coalitions. And the idea of the Republican Party cleaving into like the Whigs did made some amount of sense when it seemed like they were at a real low point in 2006 to 2012 outside of the one huge wave election. But, you know, like the problem with Democrats splitting is that like literally our entire system of government is designed not around two parties, but around these two parties.
Right.
It's and we that was done on purpose because people wanted to entrench their own power within the system. If you have so and to get to another point, too, it's like are the progressives going to and the you know, the people who are Bernie, are they going to abandon the party? I mean, I think. People have had already happened. Like the Democratic Party has already lost voters who could be inspired to become Democratic voters. Like there's this idea that centrists scold non-voters for not doing their duty, but it's like it's the responsibility of the party to get these people to get up and vote. But anyway, that's a long way of saying like I think that if the split happens, you can't within our current electoral system, you cannot create a new party, and that like there are still forces like vying for control within the Democratic Party.
I mean, that's the biggest thing that scares me about Joe Biden is just that he's just there's going to be too many voters who are just going to be sidelined.
Yeah,
and you know, Castro the other day in one of his exit interviews was talking about the African American vote.
Yeah.
And dropped by, I don't know, 8 percentage points. And, you know,
that's
Milwaukee, you know, Detroit and Philadelphia. Yeah. And there's the election.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I keep saying this and, you know, if I had a couple $100,000, maybe I would do this polling myself, but I'm quite convinced that the African American cohort that is supporting Biden are incredibly reliable voters.
Yes.
Whereas the African American cohort that is supporting Bernie, and I would just say, you know, broadly, but brown people as well who are supporting Bernie are probably less reliable voters.
Oh, they're younger.
Yes.
Yeah, they're younger. But I would also say, like, that's not, you know, I just think that
you can't trust us millennials.
Well, I don't think it's just a matter of age. I don't think it's just a matter
and
of
less
age.
Wealthy and.
I just think
metrics.
That just broadly speaking, they're less reliable voters.
And also just more alienated from the system.
Yes, like, exactly.
And they don't feel a part of this, like.
But from just a sheerly from an electoral analysis, he's bringing in voters. The cohort that supports Biden will vote for any Democrat.
Yes.
The cohort that supports Bernie will be far more selective.
Yes.
And maybe even selective is not even the right word, because I don't think it's a question of they're saying, well, I think it's just a question of what inspires them.
Yes, exactly.
And brings them out. I don't think it's quite as much of like, I won't do that guy, but I'll do that guy, but I won't do that person, I won't do that person, you know, like that. I think it's just I'm being drawn to something.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So on the party question that we've been talking about, I think we'd all agree that we're currently being presented with probably the best shot at realigning the Democratic Party into something more working class and progressive since the neoliberal turn happened. And if this fails, where are people going to go?
I mean, they
could try to start a labor party, but there are massive obstacles to that. I think the most committed progressive electoralists will not give up. They'll double down and they'll keep going. And I think some people are going to become somewhat black-pilled on electoralism and on the system as a route to change. And people, I mean, here's where I come in, right? Because I'm participating in these struggles alongside everybody else. I want to be wrong. I want Bernie to win so bad. I'm doing everything I can. But, you know, if that fails and people are looking for answers, I want to be able to present them with some alternative choices, some other options, such as direct action, massive amounts of labor organizing. And all of this stuff is stuff we should be doing anyway, even if Bernie wins.
Right. I mean, they're not mutually exclusive. I think one of the big fears that I had about Obama was that there was going to be a whole generation of people who were very excited about Obama who got completely turned off.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that happened in the way
it happened in an interesting way because they got angry and were like, let's not let that happen again.
Right. 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 And I mean, you know, look, I think that Bernie has, I am as optimistic about Bernie's chances now as I've been at any time. I think
honestly, me too. Yeah.
But like the idea that, if Bernie doesn't win, you know, it's sort of like the, you know, the old Batman show. It's like, okay, you tried to kill Batman and you guys left the room when you had this, you know, the crazy contraption. Just next time, just do the crazy contraption, stay in the room. Like, it's just because, like, if Bernie, you don't have to come up with a whole new crazy contraption. Just next time, just, like, you know, do marginal improvement on what you were doing. And I think, you know, the thing that encourages me is that there is 4 years down the road, 8 years down the road, I see, you know, potential candidates in the Democratic Party.
And that's because we've talked about this generational aspect of the Democratic thing before, where for years they shut out every like leftist and even real progressive. That's why the Gen X Democrats suck. That's why they suck.
Yes.
But they're actually like when they will be in charge for a while now, but there will be younger ones who are better.
I do not think the Gen X Democrats will be in charge. Who?
I mean, that's a good point because the
Crowley,
the boomers like didn't even let them take any power.
That's right. Crowley was the only guy.
They wouldn't even let anyone else like.
They wouldn't let anybody else. And that's the thing is, I think we're going to skip the Gen X. And you know what? I mean, I call you me know, a generation, generation traitor, but I'm down with it.
Except when you run for president on the Libertarian ticket, right?
Except for when I run for president or, you know, who knows what else I might run
for.
Who
knows?
All right. Final call of the day. Calling from a 614 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Oh, hey, this is Rince from Melbourne.
Rince from Melbourne. Welcome to the program. Melbourne, Australia, I presume.
That's it. Melbourne, Australia. Just before I get to talking about the fires, I wanted to call out and then apologize to Jamie. About months ago, Australia came up and her immediate reaction was, "Ugh, Australia is racist." And I thought, oh, geez, that's a bit rough. And then the very next day, our parliament passed a white supremacist motion saying it's okay to be white. And I thought, I really need to apologize to Jamie for that.
Thank you. I accept your apology.
Fantastic. Look, I just want to talk about the fires very quickly, just to give the American listeners a bit of an idea about how big they are. It's as if Vermont, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts combined were all on fire.
Wow.
All at once.
And how concentrated? I mean, like, because, you know, if that was to happen and I lived in, you know, I don't know. California doesn't mean anything to me. I shouldn't mean anything to me, but it's not materially impacting me, particularly if I live in California because the winds are blowing the other way. But this is not that concentrated, right? I mean, it's actually spread out more in a linear fashion.
So we have a fire front. It's fairly big. If you were to draw the line of the fire front, it would stretch from New York to Afghanistan. It materially affects basically everyone. I'm in Melbourne, so I'm about 400 kilometres away from the nearest kind of large fire. Melbourne is covered in smoke.
Wow.
Yeah, so 400 kilometres is about 250 miles. We're covered in smoke. Like, I can't even see the central business district, and I'm only a few kilometers away.
Wow.
It's pretty serious. The air quality here is among the worst in the world at the moment. Actually, our capital, Canberra, has the worst air quality in the world at the moment. So, like, worse than Mumbai, worse than Delhi. It's pretty serious. You know, we've got...
And we should say that, just to give people a sense, from Sydney through to Canberra to Melbourne would basically be like from Boston to New York to Washington, D.C., more or less.
More or less.
That corridor.
Yeah, that's right. That's where the majority of people live in the country, and that's where the halls of power are. Just to follow on your line of blaming the electorate, now, elections have consequences. This is... obviously climate change is to blame for the intensity of these fires, but, you know, in
the last decade or two, several Liberal, which is the right-wing government here, state and federal governments have cut funding to the Rural Fire Service. So they've cut equipment, they've cut money, they've cut the ability for people to go and do controlled burns to reduce fuel load. I mean, this isn't even the worst of it. This is the result of emissions from 20 years ago. We've got serious problems, and we've had over half a billion animals killed. We've had entire ecosystems completely wiped out. They're never going to recover.
Wow. And so, I mean, is there a sense, are people saying, we need to get through this season? And, I know there's been, a drought for, 3 years. Is there even a hope for, some type of seasonal relief?
Most of the fire chiefs at the moment are saying that the season may not actually finish until May, which is, the end of autumn.
Wow.
Our fire season this year started in September. That's spring. We're not supposed to have fires in spring. This is just going to take a nation building effort for us to fix. We're actually having people evacuated by the Navy and the Royal Australian Air Force from some of these towns like Mallacoota and Cobargo. I can tell you what the people at Cobargo were saying if you want to hear it.
Oh, yeah, I guess.
Sensitive American.
Yeah, why don't you tell us what it was?
Look, I guess that clip is kind of emblematic of the leadership in the country at the moment. At least when Trump went to Puerto Rico, when he was shooting hoops with those
paper
towels and stuff at the crowd, at least he took something. Or at least someone on his team had the wherewithal to say, maybe you should take these people who are desperate for help something. Mm-hmm. But he had a convoy of 6 to 8 vehicles, no water, no food, no relief of any kind, no promise of funding.
Wow.
He actually reaches out and grabs that woman's hand when she's telling him she doesn't want to touch him. And then he walks away as soon as she asks for help. Or she asks him for help and he turns his back on her and just walks away. And that is actually a perfect encapsulation of our current government's response to climate change and to this particular emergency. I mean, it's really brutal. And this is not to blame the electorate, but elections have consequences, and
right.
And this is just one of them. This is just the start. It's just going to get worse. The drought probably won't end because we've been deforesting large swaths of land faster than the Amazon. So we're not going to have any of the natural water cycle. So we're not going to generate much rain. This is apocalyptic for Australians.
Right.
And people in New Zealand, which is over 2,000 kilometres away, they're getting affected by the smoke.
Wow.
It's ridiculous.
Can you give us a sense of the state of the Australian left right now? Because I don't know as much about Australian politics as I would like to. I know that there were some shady plots back in the 70s, I believe, to keep socialists out of power, if I'm getting that right.
Oh, yeah. So, let me just thank the CIA for rolling our prime minister in the 1974. Really appreciate that, America. That's great.
Anytime, literally.
That's not contested or a conspiracy. That's literally what happened. So the state of the Australian left. Full disclosure, I'm a member of the Greens Party here. We're the left as far as the electorate is concerned. We just had an election in May, and we have two major parties: the Liberal Party, which is the right-wing party, and the Labor Party, which is historically a left-wing party, but has took a turn, hard turn towards neoliberalism after the coup in the 1970s. So we kind of have a right-wing party, and I guess you could call them a centrist party. They do have some left ideas, but the Labor Party took hundreds of detailed, costed policies to the election, and lost. We had polling showing them winning pretty much nonstop for the last 3 years of government. And, we went to the election and they lost it. So we've got another 3 years of the Liberal Party, the right-wing party, and doing tax cuts for large corporations and agribusiness. The left, I guess to get back to your question, is not particularly in a great shape. We don't have a strong left. We don't have really a strong independent media either. You know, over 70% of our print media is owned by Rupert Murdoch. A large majority of the television. And, yeah, well, no, he's American. You can have him.
Right. Well, I got to say, you know, I have a feeling that if we're in a position to have history, have a clear-eyed vision, that Rupert Murdoch may go down as one of the most sort of destructive characters in this century, in the late 20th century. You know, I mean, obviously, there were some other pretty big villains, but in the era of like non-military,
Well, in terms of long-term consequences, what he's done to political culture in the entire Anglosphere cannot be underestimated.
Well, listen, Rince, I really appreciate the call. Call back with an update for us.
Sure thing. Take care, everybody. Thanks. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Bye-bye. All right, folks. That is all the time we have. Alex Perine, always a pleasure.
Of course.
Folks can check out Alex's piece, A Decade of Liberal Delusion and Failure in the New Republic, which I got to say, like, I get it. It's sort of bizarre. Like, I have a print subscription, obviously a digital subscription as well. When the New Republic comes, I have, like, I'm still... Like adjusting.
Yeah. Like you like look at it and you're like,
It was for many years. I was just like, and it's just a very weird corrective.
Yeah.
And I like it. I'm enjoying it. The writing is great. And,
it's a good weird.
It's a good weird. It is a good weird. All right, folks, we will see you on Monday. Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice was made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I shifted in and out of you, waiting for my moment to happen. I don't know how much longer.